Good afternoon and welcome to Tickling the Belly of the Beast from the heartland of Santa Cruz. I want to apologize for a little bit of a late start, but I've got a great program lined up for you and co-hosting with me. The first hour is Teresa Caraggio, and she has her own program, Third Paradigm. I'm sure you're all aware of it. Wonderful. And our first guest today is Patricia Rain. She is local, and we're going to be learning about fair trade and the magic of vanilla bean. We're going to learn a lot more. And the second hour, we're going to be speaking with Alex Utterman and Jonathan Rosen about the subtleties of the soul, spiritual healing, and spiritual truth. And then from 4 to 5, we'll be speaking again with Julia Longerman about the true history of Mexico and the massacre of the Spanish royalists. But Patricia is here with us now live, and I want to give a brief introduction about her. She is an internationally recognized author, speaker, and educator, and a powerful global voice of the earth, indigenous growers, sustainable agriculture, farmers, and women worldwide. She is the author of Vanilla Bean and Vanilla Chef and the Cultural History of the World's Favorite Flavor and Fragrance. I want to welcome you, Patricia.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Oh, I'm so glad. I've been looking at your website quite a bit, and it appears to me that you're living your dream right now.
In many respects, I absolutely am. It's taken a long time to bring it all to where it is now, but it's been an interesting journey.
Yes, you wrote that as a child you were always interested in vanilla, and the magic. It's magic. And also care deeply about the people in the developing part of the world. And you're doing so much now for them. And you've been called the Vanilla Queen. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your journey?
Well, as a child, I had bronchitis a lot, so I read when I was in my bed just everything I could get my hands on. And that included people like Helen Keller and Pearl Buck and Albert Schweitzer. Uh-huh. And it really intrigued me. I had some inclination that somehow I would do something like they did. Though, of course, uh-huh. At 8 years old, I didn't exactly have a plan. At the same time, I started cooking when I was 4, and my mother gave me an empty bottle of Schilling's vanilla when I was 5. And I would sit outside and just smell the aroma. And it didn't take me to tropical countries because I didn't have a clue where it was from. What I have since learned is that the aroma of vanilla is something that is also a component in mother's milk, which is why we as humans are so hardwired to the aroma of vanilla. So the irony of all of this is that they were two very disparate components, but they all came together slowly but surely in 1985 when I wrote a book called The Vanilla Cookbook. My interest as much in food was always been the cultures because my training was in anthropology. So the book itself was a story about the growers, a brief history about vanilla. And this was all pre-internet, of course, so it was whatever the local research librarians and I could find, as well as talking with some of the key vanilla traders in the world. And the book came into life in 1986. Everything could have ended right then, except that I was into promoting the book and got a hold of Sunset Magazine and offered to come down and talk to their editorial staff about vanilla because I thought it was interesting enough that they might want to incorporate something into their program. So I went down there, and unknown to me, Jerry DeVecchio, who was the editor-in-chief at that time, was working with the Academy of Sciences in San Francisco on a program called Foods the Americas Gave the World, Chilies to Chocolate. And they did not have an expert on vanilla. And I was invited to speak. Now, I'd been living out in the countryside, and I hadn't spoken in front of a large group of people. So, and all these people were really famous. I felt like the kindergartner walking into the fifth grade classroom to give a talk.
You know? I bet you shone, though.
Well, I learned.
Because you knew what you were talking about.
Well, it was good because I learned that day when the lights went down and all I had was the little podium light that I desperately needed glasses. And oops. I had no idea. I needed readers. And I couldn't read my notes.
Oh, no.
And then the first slide was upside down. And it was just like, oh, my God. How am I going
this is worse than I imagined.
Oh, it was a bizarre combination. Well, I pulled it off. What was even more surprising to me was that the University of Berkeley made a book about the program based on the key components of the Americas. And only two of us who were speakers were actually featured in the book, which I found quite surprising. But what also you start one thing and you have no idea where it's going to take you, of course. And writing the book, I really hadn't any thought about what would come next. But it turns out that when this program was set up, it was concocted by an anthropologist who had been in New Mexico. Now, this is 1987, when she was putting the program together. she had no idea how popular food was in California. Because in New Mexico, she could barely get three people to talk more than 10 minutes about food. So she...
Unimaginable.
Yeah. She rented this little room at the Academy of Sciences that only held 400 visitors. So when they put the program out to the members of the Academy of Sciences, it sold out in 2 days. So the general public never got to come. Well, so many anthropologists were upset about this that they ended up doing a video of the program. And based on the video, the Autonomous University of Mexico decided to do a program on the crossover of the food traditions from the old world to the new world at the 500-year anniversary of the conquest. So suddenly I was off to New Mexico, and they were paying, which was all the better, of course. And I thought, you know, I'm already going there. I really ought to go down to the vanilla growing region and see what it's like. So I booked myself a flight. I couldn't find anybody in the States who could tell me a thing about where I was going. At the conference in San Francisco, the keynote speaker, I found out after he had died that I was related to him by marriage. I had no idea. And he was the anthropologist that determined when corn went from a seed to an actual edible ear.
Wow.
And so he knew this region very well. So he just said, well, you get on a bus and you head towards this area.
And you have an adventuresome spirit as well.
Well, yes, I do. I was a little nervous. And so after the program, I thought, well, in Mexico, someone will tell me. Nobody had a clue. So I went to the bus station. I really didn't even have enough cash because I didn't understand how the changing system worked, where you go to change your money, or that the banks have very peculiar hours. I'd lived in Guatemala many, many years before, but not, hadn't been in a Latin American country for 20 some odd years. And so at least I spoke Spanish. But at any rate, I went to the bus station, and I just chose a bus that happened to go at about the time I thought would work. Fortunately, I chose that bus, because I later learned this is one of the main conduits for the immigrants leaving Mexico to the States.
Mm.
And consequently, most of the buses stop along the way to pick up immigrants. So the buses are targets for the bandits who know that the immigrants are traveling with cash. I chose, quite by blessed fortune, the one line that went straight through, did not stop, checked every passenger getting on the bus with a metal detector to make certain that they were not bringing on a gun.
Mm-hmm.
And then I took off. And in the process, I was standing next to the man who looked like the most intelligent person in the bus depot. And I said to him in Spanish, I'm going to Papantla, Veracruz. Do you know anything about the area? And he said, well, yes. And I said, where are you going? And he said, well, I'm going near there. And somebody had left a bag next to him that turns out not to have been his bag, but it said property of the U.S. And I said, are you an American? And he said, yes. And I said, well, I'm an American, too, and I'm an anthropologist. And he said, well, I'm an anthropologist.
Oh, my gosh.
And he stopped everything and traveled with me for 4 days and took me all through the area. including finding what he took me to. Isn't that remarkable?
It really is.
And we even went to see where Che Guevara and Fidel had fled after, you know, when they first started the revolution at the Bay of Pigs, and they were off the coast in Tegucigalpa. And he showed me the museum.
You could just do a show on that.
Oh, I know, because I also went to Cuba later, and so I had to have a lot of interesting stuff that ties in with that.
Certainly do.
So, anyway, when I got there, it wasn't this trip, but the following trip. Because after I finished spending my time in Papantla, I decided to go see the rest of southern Mexico that I could afford. Mm-hmm. So I just took buses all through southern Mexico. And I just couldn't stop thinking about this little hill town with the Totonaco people who were the first vanilla growers.
Yes.
And I decided to go back. On the second trip, I reconnected with the man who ran the chicken roasting company, whom I later discovered was a gangster who had the chicken roasting company as a money laundering machine. And he invited me to come and stay with his family while I did some research. And a friend of his took me out that first night to meet the vanilla growers. Well, it was hot as a pistol, of course. It was October, and nobody stays inside at night. Everybody's outside. And he couldn't believe that I had come on a bus from Mexico City to, in his quote, this forsaken place. And
I know, probably wondered, who is this American woman? She must be hopelessly lost.
His wife wouldn't come.
Happened?
She came once and left 2 hours later. She wanted nothing to do with the whole area. So I got taken to the first vanilla growers. And he yells out to his friend in Spanish, "Hey, Nico, there's this woman. She wants to see you. I don't know why she's here. Her name's Patricia Rain." And the vanilla grower goes, "Patricia Rain? La Patricia Rain? Oh, my God, come in. I have your book. I want you to sign it." Well, it turns out that the people at McCormick, the man at McCormick, whom I had interviewed and I first met and who is still my friend, had brought my book to this town after it was written and had given it to all the vanilla growers. And I was a minor celebrity in this ancient town. And they all had vanilla-stained books that they couldn't really read because they didn't speak English, but they recognized the photographs, they recognized words, and obviously I cared.
Yes, and that, you put them on the map.
Yes, and that
you gave them a voice.
That started this very unlikely journey, and they asked me, could I help them resuscitate the Mexican industry, which in fact I have not truly been able to do. But what I did next was I bought a fax machine, I traded for vanilla beans, and they had an easier way to be in contact. I started selling vanilla.
You're probably one of the first fair traders.
Yes, and I have something to say about fair trade. I love the idea. Mm-hmm. And Teresa and I actually talked about the issue of fair trade and organics. Fair trade and organics work in certain sectors and with certain products. When you're looking at vanilla, you're looking at 2,300 metric tons a year, which is not very much. When you're looking at coffee, you are looking at 10 million containers of coffee. When you're looking at chocolate, you're looking at 5.4 million containers. I can't give you the statistics on sugar or bananas, but they're equally large. And the reality is, those are products, those are commodities that are traded publicly. The information about them is transparent. Now, that doesn't mean that the farmers have gotten a fair shake. They haven't. But vanilla is so small that the farm and so opaque, because it's not traded publicly, that the farmers have historically never known what the price is from year to year. Mm-hmm. And they have depended on the people that came to buy the vanilla from them and just basically had to accept whatever was given to them. So what I found with fair trade is that it can work with coffee. It can work with sugar. It can work with cacao or chocolate. It can work with bananas. Why? Because even if the farmers themselves have only 1 or 2 hectares of land, and that translates to about 2.5 acres per hectare, they are often put into collectives, either by programs that are working to assist farmers or collectives that have been created at a grassroots level. That way, the fair trade price and the organic prices are covered by an outside group. If you are a vanilla grower, or, and this is true for a lot of coffee growers, especially in the Americas, they with 2 hectares of land, you're not producing a whole heck of a lot of product. You cannot afford the $5,000 a year minimum for fair trade or organic certification. And I say fair trade, I'm not quite sure what fair trade prices are, but organic certification is roughly $5,000 or more per certification. Okay, so right there, they're out of the picture. But let's say they make it. I come to buy from them. They want $50 a kilo for their dried vanilla. I'm buying from someone who has grown part of the vanilla, and he has gotten part of that vanilla from a lot of the poorer farmers. He's bought it green from them, and he's cured and dried it. He's got to have fair trade certification for his facility to cure and dry their beans. And they've already had to come up with this money. So he's come up with a significant amount of money. I need to have fair trade and organic certification to buy those beans from him. I have to have a storage unit that keeps fair trade and organic separate from conventionally traded vanilla. I then have paid, let's say, $80 a kilo for the vanilla that I would have paid $50 a kilo for. I have to then sell it to the restaurants, to the bakeries, to the small food manufacturers who want certified organic. For enough to cover my costs, plus a small margin of profit. And trust me, on vanilla, there's a very small margin of profit. So by the time this vanilla finally gets to the end user, let's say a consumer who's really adamant about wanting organic, it could cost upwards of $100 a kilo or more. Now, if I went back to those farmers, they had originally wanted $50 a kilo, and I paid them $50 a kilo, and I sold it for $80 a kilo, let's say. I've made a little money, they've made a little money, and it's going to be sold cheaper, and maybe I've sold it for $70 a kilo. So they've sold more vanilla than they would have at the higher price. So one of the ideas, and I think you were the person, Teresa, who said to me, eco-humane is a term that could be used. And another term can be ethically traded.
I am in complete agreement with this. I think there are so many issues with the organic label that when I see it now, what it means to me is that someone's big enough to have the money to be able to pay for that. And it and organic says nothing about how the people are being treated.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
So organic means little to me, except that at least the environment isn't being harmed. And so if there's only those two choices, I generally will make that one. Fair trade, the good thing about it is that it by implication, let people know that there was a question about the trade that was going on with all the rest. Mm-hmm. So it opened up the conversation. But I've been looking for a different kind of investment paradigm that would change that would change how we do business altogether. We have another mutual friend, Gardner, who's had a home delivery bread service.
Yes.
Since the time that he and I both have high school seniors this year, and when they were both in first grade together, I said to him, you know, I would gladly pay you to bring me bread like this, you know, every week.
His and bread's it, awesome, by the way, for anyone out there who hasn't had it.
Amazing. And he shook my hand and said, that's just what I've wanted to start. So for many years, he did it on the side while working at Beckman's or at Gale's. And then a couple years ago, went full on. So his truck was breaking down. And so I said, well, you know, I can do a long-term investment. And what you can pay me in is bread for the next 10 years.
Yes.
And then I started doing this thing that we call Food in the Hood. And Gardner was one of my main supporters with this, with the person who did my logo for my third paradigm and also for Food in the Hood. And they said, you know, we'll start where every week I'll do cook foods, you know, so I'll have soups and main dishes and desserts. And then I have Gardner's bread. So I'll have 7 loaves of his bread tomorrow in my front yard. And we've been doing this every Friday now since last June. And people come and they take whatever they want, and then they donate to whatever global charity we're supporting.
Fantastic.
So so far we've raised $5,800 for global charities. We just did a potluck for Nigeria.
Wow.
The other night. Great. It's been really fun. I've met so many neighbors. And it's made me think that that is, I think, a model that could be expanded globally, where
absolutely.
I could invest money. It's like you were saying with the fax machine of trading tools, that the most important thing, you know, they already in Latin America, they already have the resources, they have the labor. The thing that they need are tools.
Absolutely.
So if we can trade tools, which are generally from this country or another country, and ship them down there and trade and just say, you know, if you have a bad season and you don't have it, that's okay because you never owe me money. Mm-hmm. What you owe me is product and you owe me at this, you know, discounted rate. But, you know, that's all that you pay me in.
When you
know,
can.
You just pay me in product. And it's fair. It's fair to both sides. You know, there's interest. So, but the interest is always in product.
That's great. Well, one last thing I'd like to say.
Get rid of the interest.
Finish the whole fair trade concept, organic concept. Something I learned after organic became a bigger field, force rather, I should say, in the vanilla industry, is that the very large corporations, and I am going to use names, but I don't know that these names are the ones who have done this, but it's just easier in terms of explaining what I want to say. But a huge corporation like Nestle or Danesco, who might use vanilla for yogurt or for some other product that they're producing, or a huge ice cream. Nestle owns Dreyer's, and they own Häagen-Dazs and a number of companies. So
they just keep growing.
I know, they do. Everybody's just being swallowed up. So what happens is they find out that there is a major collective in Papua New Guinea. And Papua New Guinea is a pretty new producer of vanilla, but the government has invested in that, and I'm all for it because Papua New Guinea,
the people that lived there had to be jolted out of a traditional culture and into the 20th century with no preparation near the end of the 20th century and are not really completely into the 21st century. There are individuals, yes, but, you know, as a whole country, it's been very, very difficult. And they've been taken advantage of, like most traditional cultures, because it's a mineral-rich country, resource-rich, a lot of timber and other products. So the government helped them set up organic programs. Uh-huh. Vanilla, by the way, does not need fertilizers and pesticides.
Oh.
A lot of coffee doesn't either. Cacao's a little different, but not significantly different. The problems come in when the hybrids that have been created to be grown in sun rather than shade.
Mm-hmm.
That's where a lot of problems occur. But here are these farmers. They've been certified organic. The collective is doing well. A big corporation comes in and says, we will buy all of your conventional vanilla if you will exclusively sell us your organic. So this undercuts any of the small companies that are trying to make an organic product.
Yeah.
And although the organic label says 96% of the product has to be used organically, and you have 4%, you don't have to have certified organic, which means that maybe you're not going to have the cinnamon or the nutmeg or the vanilla, something. The reality is that it's almost impossible to get the organic. That's changing a little bit, but not significantly. And so food is so ripe for politics.
It is.
And especially because
we
need it to survive. And we as...
It is a commodity.
It is. And as a global power...
Just as water is changing as well.
Water is a very scary, very scary issue.
Why not?
And
monetization of just about everything. And you know firsthand. And you created the Farmers Network, International Tropical Farmers Network, as well as part of your Google group.
Yes.
And if we have time, I'd like to go over that a little bit and what you're doing.
Well, in 2005, when vanilla prices started to collapse, the vanilla farmers that I had met via my site, and by the way, give myself a little plug here.
Absolutely.
I own vanilla.com. Pretty easy to remember. And it really has been the conduit for meeting vanilla farmers worldwide and other farmers. So having met a large number of vanilla farmers, I stayed in touch with those who had access to the internet, and quite honestly, in Papua New Guinea, that often meant a four-hour ride in a lorry, as they call it, some old truck, out of the village and into Port Moresby or even into Waywak, which is part of the area where a lot of vanilla is grown, and they would find an internet cafe. Ditto for the African farmers. Indian farmers were largely gentlemen farmers investing on what they saw was going to be a great boon and didn't know the industry well enough to know that it was going to have a huge collapse. But there were also small farmers that got into growing vanilla. But worldwide, when the prices went from $10 a kilo to over $200 a kilo, the farmers all started planting. And when they hit $500 a kilo, it became as dangerous as the drug trade and actually wasn't very good for them. And then it collapsed because there was far too much vanilla in the market and the big companies went to imitations. That's a whole other topic.
Oh, it certainly is.
So what happened was all these farmers were saying, well, what in the world are we going to do? I had just finished being in the inaugural program of Women Leaders for the World, which was a group of 19 women mm-hmm. who were already doing something in a leadership position mm-hmm. and had found out about this program, applied, had been accepted, and went. And it was through Santa Clara University in conjunction with the with the Levy School of Business. So, and it's under the Global Women's Leadership Network. So, I had been in that program, and I noticed that we as a graduating group were going to be put on a Google group, and I had the aha moment and said, this is what I'll do. I'll put these folks all on this group, and if they speak enough English to be able to more or less understand the conversation and have access in one way or another to the internet, we can change information back and forth. And the first 2 years, it was unbelievable.
I bet it was very successful.
It was amazing, and including an Indonesian man who didn't speak English very well, but that didn't stop him. And
he came over here.
No, it was all by internet.
Oh, my word.
I know. And a man from the Comoro Islands wrote to me and said, never in my life did I think I might meet somebody from Tahiti or Papua New Guinea or Costa Rica or Mexico. He was astonished. So we even put on a conference in Mexico, and up to this point, and Mexico, of course, being the birthplace of vanilla, had had so many conferences, but the indigenous people never came because they cost a lot of money.
Yeah,
and there had been a conference in Mexico 7 months before our conference that cost $900 plus airfare, plus food, plus lodging. So even though the Mexicans didn't have to pay necessarily lodging, though it was held in the Port of Veracruz, which is about 2.5 hours from the vanilla growing region, 2.5 to 3 hours, they would have had to pay for some cheap place to sleep. So of course it was prohibitive.
Yeah.
Two Mexicans came to the conference.
Oh, dear.
They were people who were already higher up the echelon financially.
Sure.
And could afford. And one who was a grower plus cured and dried the vanilla came for free as a speaker. Mm-hmm. Three people.
Bare subsistence level. They have nothing to spare.
So I said, this conference must be free to everyone. It must be available in Spanish, in mm-hmm. English, and in Totonaco. It must have food, mm-hmm. and it must have childcare mm-hmm. if people want childcare. So the mm-hmm. organizers in Mexico had some funds through a program that they operated through the government. They then went to the government and asked for more money. And the government kicked and screamed, but finally said, oh, well, why not, and gave them some cash. I worked behind the scenes at this end because I had an annoying little problem of a very advanced metastatic cancer. So I wasn't able to be there. And I was furious. And it was early June. It was over Memorial Day weekend. It was gorgeous here. I was in aggressive chemo, and I had been in aggressive chemo for months. Aww. And I had chemo 2 days before, so I was in my crashed cycle. Mm. And on an air bed in the living room so I could look out at the beautiful day. And I was in tears because mm-hmm. I had no idea how the conference was going. And there was no way to find out.
Yeah.
Well, finally that night, I got an email from a festival
Internet
that they had put on. No, it was from a hotel where they had had a big festival for all the attendees. 2,500 people showed up for this conference.
Oh, my word.
2,500. There were people that were tied in with the university, who were sociologists and anthropologists, the media. The government came and made their speeches and left, though their mouths were open as they watched the people pouring in through the gates.
They learned something.
The indigenous people were there. They had to simulcast it in Spanish, English, French, and Totonac. There were fair trade people from Montreal. There were people who had come from everywhere. And some of the indigenous farmers who had gotten a college education by promising to teach in the mountain schools. What they would be is like a Totonac student who wanted to go to college, could get 4 years of training, and usually they would go into agronomy in exchange for going into the mountain schools, where the schools are bilingual now. They used to be forced to speak in Spanish, but now they're in Totonac and Spanish. And they contacted me, probably from internet cafes, saying, we trust you, but how do we know to trust the people putting on the conference? And I said, this is for you. Go. You. And I said,
you worked hard.
They rented a bus to get the farmers down there.
Wow.
Isn't that just
awesome? Amazing. It really is. And knowing you in your spirit and just meeting you now, I bet we could sit here and hear many other stories of similar
There have been
success.
Some awesome moments.
Patricia,
and a lot of difficulties.
You were ahead of your time. First the People Summit on vanilla, now the People Summit on climate change. There's been the People Summit on in Honduras, writing the new constitution.
It's, you were part of?
Yeah, it's a trend that just has been going to, let's just forget the government, the corporate, let's stop fighting and let's do our own thing.
It's it's international grassroots organization,
it is,
and
it is.
That
you
is
mastered it.
Difficult because you have to deal, and this is why I said that the Google group is all but dead at this point, because we didn't have the funds to take it to the next level. And this is why I expanded my website to represent all tropical commodities, because most farmers, when a product drops in price, they'll grow something else. Yeah. Or, ideally, if they have the space, they grow more than one product simultaneously. And they all face the same issues. And what my dream had been, and unfortunately cancer interrupted the dream in a strong enough way that I haven't had the time, energy, or the resources to do the fundraising and take this vision to the next level, which has been starting an international tropical farmers network NGO and using my website.
Well, we only have about five more minutes, and right now I want to ask what we can do to help you.
Thank you. That's
You're
wonderful.
Welcome. You just to
At this point, I'm working with an advertising executive who is retired, who has donated his time pro bono, and if this actually goes, of course, we'll get some money, to put together a business plan around getting some of the bigger companies, and we're targeting at the moment Newman's Own Organics with our vanilla sugars. Whether this is going to work or not, I don't know. I would like to get our vanilla sugars into Pete's Coffee or into Rogers Family Coffee, which is an extremely green group. If we can get some of our products selling, so that we show that we have some money, because after 6 years of dealing with cancer, I have run out of steam. We can then hopefully get some angel money, which we need to be able to take my site to the next site, next level, pardon me, where we can turn this into a community project similar to care2.com. That's care with the number 2.com. A brilliant green and healthy living site that started in 1998, and I'm sure started with some investment capital. But by getting a project like that started, anybody can come at any day and find out about an eco tour that might involve a week of whitewater rafting and a week of helping build a school, mm-hmm. or going to a women's clinic in Tanzania, or to a school, or just plug in some cash.
Yeah.
So if people listening go to vanilla.com and go to the awareness section or the yes we can section, mm-hmm. you will see just the beginning of where I want this project to go. There also happen to be some great recipes. Oh, and did I mention we sell vanilla? That keeps our bills paid so that we can do this.
If I can build on that idea, what I wanted to partner with is a vanilla agave syrup. So that everyone does vanilla lattes. Mm-hmm. You know, vanilla syrup is used in all these fair trade coffee products, but there is no fair trade vanilla syrup.
Yes.
So with my Food in the Hood group, what I've wanted to do is to partner to do an investment and to get this product and then have it be sold so that every time someone orders a vanilla latte, there's a 50-cent donation that comes back and that then goes to different indigenous groups to be able to strengthen their participation mm-hmm. and their communities and their own sovereignty.
Well, I know a lot of agave producers, and so
well,
or at least sellers.
Well,
and we could also take that one more step and sell vanilla cream sodas.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
We can take the vanilla agave and sell the product itself.
Yes.
There you go. So, and vanilla iced tea.
And I want to put in a last plug for your book, because I think I met you 4 years ago at the farmer's market at Christmas, and the book Vanilla is fascinating. It combines anthropology, history, politics, biology. It's just one of those spectrum. It just has a little bit of everything, and it is a fascinating read.
And it's cheap. We have it on sale on my site. So
right.
Please come by. aren't I terrible? But
so
we
please.
Need funds to make these things work. And I have to always remember that without having the capital, a lot of these projects can't exist.
And knowing you, you would give freely.
I have.
You have. And it's
very
time
freely.
You need to survive, too.
Yes.
And you've given a tremendous amount with so many in the world. It's like you've opened up your heart.
I have a great
so
big
many.
Family. And
do.
I have to say, when I pray, I just say, this includes my entire family, not, not my biological family alone.
And you walk your talk.
Yes.
You really do. You see what needs to be done. You think about it. You talk. It sounds like you do the research. And you come up with something that's going to work for everyone. You can fine-tune it, too, I'm sure, just as Teresa.
Yes. Thank you so much for letting us come
on. Oh, thank you for coming on, both of you.
And thank you for listening.
We have to move on. We'll come back and talk about your other projects. And
terrific. I would love to come back.
Your in Guatemala. I, too, spent some time there. And
oh, marvelous.
It's the richest time of my life. My heart is still down there in Guatemala. I see Guatemala on the map, and I see a big heart. Mine. It's still there. We'll talk about where we were. Well, thank you.
And thank
you. So very much. This hour just flew. Thank
it
you,
did.
Teresa.
Thank you so much for letting me come on. And
you're welcome. We'll
see
do it again.
Again.
Now we're going to hear a little bit of, let's see, my computer skills are going to bring on Tatanka. Let's see. It's about to come on, and then we'll be talking with Jonathan Rosen.
Oh, hey, yeah.
That was Tatanka, and with me now online, on the phone, I have Jonathan Rosen and Alex Utterman. And we're going to be learning about their, well, basically their dedication to life of service, I'd say, and learning about spiritual healing, spiritual truth, and truly the subtleties of the soul. Let me see if I have them on here. Jonathan, are you with me?
Yes, Cindy. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Very well.
Good. Could you speak up just a little bit?
Yeah, sure.
There we go. I think I've got it now.
Good.
Great. Wow.
And here's Alex as well.
Hi, Alex.
Hi, Cindy.
Oh, it's good to hear your voice. Hopefully I'll see you tonight. And I'd like to start by your talking a little bit about how you met Swami Kaleshwar and what your experiences were.
Sure. I met Swami in 1997. I had been a TM meditator and TM teacher for, at that point, about 25 years. Mm-hmm. And an old friend of mine, TM friend, co-teacher of mine, had come down with a very serious, in fact, a terminal lymphoma condition. And he had had no symptoms until some lymph nodes started popping out on the surface of his body, and he went and got examined, and they said, "We're so sorry, it's too late. It's spread everywhere, and you've got 5 weeks to live."
Oh, my gosh.
And he called me and told me the news. His voice was shaking. He had tried, because of close connection with Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, the founder of TM, we was able to get a message through to Maharishi, and Maharishi sent his love and blessing back, but there was no healing.
Mm.
He tried the same with Amachi, Amritananda Mayi, the hugging ma, who is
yes.
so wonderful, and he was able to see her, and she gave her beautiful blessing and love, and again, no healing. And then he heard through the grapevine that this very young saint named Swami Kaleshwar was coming to Los Angeles and was reputed to be a miracle healer. So that's what he told me on the phone, and he said, I'm going. I have nothing to lose. And I said, okay, I'll go with you. And so we went down there to a little bungalow in South Central Los Angeles, a really rough neighborhood. And there was the very young Swami Kaleshwar. He was 24 at the time. And there were only maybe 10 people in the place.
Mm.
And he did a healing on my friend. I was standing about 2 feet away. And the healing consisted of Swami Kaleshwar rubbing his thumb and index finger together, which in the Vedic supernatural energy tradition indicates the thumb is the earth element and the index finger is the fire element.
Mm.
So he's rubbing those two fingers together, and out is coming this unbelievably fragrant flow of ash. So I had heard about this kind of thing before, but I'd never seen it.
Mm-hmm.
And the energy surrounding it was very, very arresting. And the smell of this divine fragrance was there. And he gave some of that to my friend in his mouth to eat and put a big dollop of it on his third eye, forehead region. And that's it. Snapped his fingers. Next. That was the healing. And I thought, well, okay, so he made this. To me, it obviously was not a trick. It came, I saw it come right out of his fingers. And but I thought, so what? Okay, so he can do that, so what? And that had been my long bias as a 25-year, 27-year meditator at that point.
And what was that not to look at?
These
the
flashy
miracles.
Displays yeah. of so-called miracles.
Mm-hmm.
So what was the value of it? Well, my friend went back to his home state and was about to begin an experimental treatment program, just wanting to try to do something for his condition, even though they told him there's really no hope, it's just that science will learn something. But he wanted to do it anyway, and they had to test him before beginning that program. And so they did, and they said, well, your chemo certainly worked very well because you don't have any cancer. And he said, I didn't do any chemo. Well, then, your other treatment, whatever you did, and he said, I didn't do any treatment. So when he told me that, that really caught my attention.
Yeah.
Because I had been meditating and teaching meditation and living with one of the great saints in the world, Maharshi Mahesh Yogi, for many years.
Mm-hmm.
And I had never seen anything like that. So Kaleshwar's statement to us all was, I'm not here to collect devotees.
Mm-hmm.
I'm here to find students who are serious, who want to learn how to do what I can do,
mm-hmm.
and are willing to do hard work.
Mm-hmm.
And after a few more meetings with him, a weekend seminar program up here in the Bay Area, he invited us several months later to come to India on a power journey to go to some of the high Shakti energy temples, ancient mm-hmm. Indian temples, Vedic temples, and to start absorbing and learning how to work with that energy, to become a master healer the way that he is. And so that was the start of my experience with Swami Kaleshwar.
That's amazing. It truly is.
Yeah.
And you and just the fact that he is sharing these teachings, and you have shared that this is a time in our history that there is a lot of darkness, and it's so important for people to start learning what the masters have known for centuries, and a lot of it has been kept secret.
Yes, yes. I think this is the first time in 2,000 years since Jesus
mm-hmm.
that this knowledge has been shared openly and widely.
Mm-hmm. And it couldn't be more timely. And he works, truly, he grapples and goes right in and works with our illusions.
Yeah, the illusions,
not
and
just
I'll invite
tea, but
Alex to make some comments. The illusions are kind of the what we are born into in this world,
right,
what we see all around us. Illusions in the Sanskrit and the Vedic understanding means that which is not enduring, that which is not real, permanent.
Mm-hmm.
The surface level of life, which is always changing, always being born and dying. Mm-hmm. That's the illusion level. All the ups and downs, all the dramas, all the confusions, all the mistakes, the heartbreaks, the fears, the anxieties, mm-hmm, the unworthiness, all mm-hmm of that stuff, that's all in the realm of illusion. And the spiritual path is about transforming where we live our life from the mm-hmm illusion level onto the level of truth. And, of course, it's not so easy
no
to do that. If it were easy, everybody would be doing it.
You're totally deconstructed.
Yes, deconstructing.
Put it in the fire.
Exactly.
And
right,
actually, on your website, on the first page, I love it. You, it's called the Universal. Oh, correct me. I forget offhand the name of your center.
The Universal Church of Baba's
Yes,
Kitchen.
Thank you, Alex.
No problem.
I
want
to
hear
from you.
Or we just call UCBK.
Yes, UCBK. And on the website it says, why a kitchen? Because everyone gets cooked in a kitchen. Because alchemy happens in kitchens. Because we have a dedication to feed the world, no matter what it is hungry for. Divine knowledge, healing, universal love, spiritual upliftment, whatever it is, and you do feed. Also, food and drink. You feed to the homeless as well, on all levels.
Yes, that's pretty much our program, you know. Having spent so many years in India and received so many amazing divine teachings and divine knowledge that's practical, mm-hmm, there we had to come back and share it.
Yeah.
And at a certain point in 2005, after we spent about five straight years living at the Ashram of Sri Kaleshwar in India, he sent us out. He said, go, do it, go teach, and do the healings. And
mm-hmm
so since 2005, we've been back in the Santa Cruz area doing just that.
Mm-hmm.
And slowly, it also evolved into a recognition that people are starving. They're starving
yeah
for knowledge. They're starving for healing. They're starving for some taste of the truth.
Mm-hmm.
The truth not being like, you know, a dogmatic vision of the truth, but rather, what is the reality operating behind this creation?
Mm-hmm.
And they're also physically very hungry,
mm-hmm,
especially now as the economy is going
physically too, yeah,
you know, south. Yeah,
yeah,
so people are really
starving,
hurting. And at first we started doing renegade muffin runs on the streets of Santa Cruz. You know, we would go to the parks and go to the Pacific Garden Mall and give out enormous amounts of muffins because they're easy and
I'm
they're
the
easy to chew.
Queen,
sometimes
actually
people don't have so many teeth left, you know, and it's hard to consume things like apples or whatever. But muffins are easy, and
mm
and one can carry them and even tuck one away for later if needed, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we used to do that, and then we turned into sandwiches. And so then we were making tuna fish sandwiches or egg salad and taking bagged lunches out on the streets and helping the people. And then finally, just over the last year, I guess starting November of this year, we had the amazing good fortune to fall in with the local Catholic church in Boulder Creek.
Mm-hmm.
And the priest there, Father Bob Murren, is a good friend of ours. And we have many interesting spiritual discussions back and forth with him. And we decided to collaborate on a free lunch program. So every Friday afternoon from noon to 1 at St. Michael's Catholic Church in Boulder Creek, there's a free lunch. No questions asked. It's pure vegetarian food. It's kind of gourmet, actually, because everybody
uh-huh
in this community who contributes to the food happens to be an amazing cook.
I'll attribute.
So
that
it really is Baba's Kitchen, you know, in action.
It is.
And it's
it is
in action in a Catholic church building, which is just really positive and uplifting and wonderful. And
yeah,
so far it's about 25 people are coming and the numbers are growing. It's available to anybody who's in need,
mm-hmm,
you know, whether they be really homeless because some of the guys are living under bridges, whatever, or they're a family and they cannot make ends meet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe they have a house, but that's
mm-hmm
it. And people are going without food. So it's
yeah
it's really heartwarming to all of us to be helping in that way and fulfilling this mission also from that angle.
And on so many levels you are, as well as assisting us work through our illusions.
You know, I wanted to say a word about who Baba is, because it's the Universal Church of Baba's Kitchen.
Sai
and
Baba.
Baba refers to Shirdi Sai Baba. Baba just means, in the Indian language, father. And Shirdi is a little village about 6 hours north, slightly east of Bombay, or Mumbai. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty much in the central, west-central India. And Sai is a term meaning holy. So it's not even a real name. Nobody even knows if he had a name or what it was. Shirdi is the village. Sai, holy, Baba, father.
Fascinating.
Shirdi Sai Baba is Swami Kaleshwar's master. And Kaleshwar is our master. And by extension, Shirdi Sai Baba is like our grandfather guru. And he dropped the body in 1918. He was a big, huge miracle saint, doing many of the same kinds of miracles that Jesus did in the West. And he is probably the most widely renowned and revered saint in India at this point.
Mm-hmm.
There are pictures of him, over a billion of them. Everywhere you look, there are pictures of Shirdi Sai Baba. And the reason is, when people pray to him, they ask for his help with whatever their needs are, from getting a good marriage for their children, to healing disease, to finding a better job, etc., etc. He delivers very, very effectively. And so the Indian people, who are very practical in their spirituality, love him because he gives them so much.
Mm-hmm.
And he was not that widely known in his lifetime. Toward the end of his life, he became quite renowned. One story about him that's very indicative is that people were giving him very much money in the end of his life, even though he was a beggar for his whole life. Even up to his last day, he would go out with his little begging bowl into the little village, which had maybe 50 huts, and beg for food, dal and rice, and share it with the birds and the dogs. He was a very interesting, what's called avadut character, a character who's not playing by the ordinary social norms. He is beyond all the five elements. He's a supernatural kind of character.
Mm-hmm.
So he was just sitting out under a tree, and people were walking by and looking at him, thinking originally that he was probably a psychiatric patient. But then after a while, sometimes he would motion to somebody to come over.
Mm-hmm.
And he would say, "What's wrong with you?" And they'd say, "Oh, I have some disease." And he would say, "Here, take this. It'll help." And he'd give them like a handful of peanuts.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, people thought, "Oh, that's really going to help." But they got better. And then all kinds of miraculous healings started happening through him. And finally, people were giving him lots of money as donations.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, the Indian tax collector, the agent for the British Raj in India at that time, came to observe how much money is coming in here and what share of it is rightly ours. The tax collector sat with him for a month, all day long, right next to him, observing how much money is coming in. And at the end of the day, he was observing that more was going out. Baba was giving away more money than he took in to all the poor people, to this person, to that person, to help them in their lives.
Yeah.
And every day, more is going out than is coming in. And he's keeping a record, the tax collector. And after 1 month, the difference in how much was going out was so much greater than how much was coming in, that he quit his job and became a devotee of Shirdi Sai Baba. So that's the kind of character he was.
Oh.
And he buried his power, his spiritual energy power, in four flames, four oil lamps. And he buried those oil lamps in a chamber under the ground in the town of Shirdi, right next to the spot where he lived. And there was no fuel in those oil lamps. They were... no oxygen was available to come into them. They were in a sealed chamber. And the four flames were satya, truth, dharma, perfect judgment or duty in the world, prema, love, and shanti, peace. And he buried those four flames, which were made of his spiritual energy. So this is the supernatural level that we're starting to talk on even now. And 20 years later, after his death, they dug them up to see, are these flames still burning? Because he said they'll burn for 1,000 years. And they dug up that chamber, and they looked, and there were the four flames still burning. They buried them, and again, another 15 years or so later, they dug them up. Still, they're burning. There's no fuel there. There's no oxygen there. Those four flames are powering a worldwide revival of this high cosmic, totally positive, divine, miracle energy healing, which is coming up again in the world. And Swami Kaleshwar, as Shirdi Baba's main exponent in the world, is bringing it, you know, to the whole world and training many people to become masters in those healing technologies.
Wow. Amazing story. And truly uplifting the lives of so many in a time of extreme pain. And you also spoke about Jesus and the Mother Divine. And do you want to share a little bit about maybe the last years of India that a lot of people know about, just how extensive, deep these teachings are and shared by so many, and they're now coming out and available?
Yes, well, this whole tradition, one of the, actually two major points about it, I think you've just hit, Cindy. One is the Mother Divine, the Divine Feminine, and how her nature is so powerful, who she is and what she is, not as a anthropomorphic theory or an idea or a myth, but rather as a spiritual energy principle. Is one of the key parts about this tradition of miracle healing. And certainly Jesus as one of the greatest miracle healers on the planet ever.
Absolutely.
It's interesting that he is a cornerstone of this particular spiritual tradition, as he also is, interestingly enough, in the Yogananda, in the SRF tradition, you'll see Jesus at the apex of their lineage.
That's right.
Kind of a little bit without explanation,
except
to say that he had a huge plan in conjunction with another Indian yogi named Babaji to take care of the world.
But and, you share that explanation. You really do.
So in India, you know, they all know, everybody, normal people know that Jesus was there, especially in South India. And it's pretty clear, I think, that some of those lost years from the time he's about 13 in the Gospels, and then he kind of disappears until his late 20s or early 30s, when he comes back to the Middle East to do different works, it's pretty clear that at least some of that time he did, in fact, spend in India, and that he trained with many masters, and he learned a lot of abilities and a deep understanding of life and death, and a deep understanding of what the souls are, and a deep understanding about how to dissolve suffering. How to heal heartbreak there. And one of the major points is the relationship with nature, the relationship with Mother Divine as a dynamic character, as an embodiment of the divine energy in all of our lives.
Yes.
This whole tradition, one of the things that Kaleshwar is unique about is that he's talking very openly about his relationship with the Mother Divine, the relationships that all of the great saints and yogis had with her, including some unexpected characters in spiritual history like the Buddha, that they had a direct, dynamic, conversational teaching, her teaching, them being students, relationship with Mother Divine herself. In other words, with the God energy expressed through the female principle as a form, as a tangible, you know, three-dimensional, clearly supernatural form of the mother. They were speaking with her. They were communicating with her. They were receiving her blessing to do their beautiful work. They were also becoming expert on how to handle her because, like any woman, Mother Divine's a little touchy. And she has her moods and her reactions. I think we see that very clearly right now in nature.
Yes.
Looking at the big ash storm that's over Europe and the earthquakes that have been happening the last few weeks.
Tibet.
she's touchy. She's on the move. Mm-hmm. But to the yogis and the great saints, to understand her intimately, to really know her nature, not only that, but to understand how to act in conjunction with her to bless the world.
Mm-hmm.
That's a huge, deep teaching, and mostly that's been kept secret for millennia. Most of the great saints didn't talk so much about it. One major exception to that being Ramakrishna, Sri Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, the Bengali saint of the late 1800s, who was quite open about his relationship with the mother in the form of Kali. Mm-hmm. So they understand how to interact with nature. It's important because nature is itself the expression of illusion. You were mentioning illusions earlier.
Yes, yes, yes.
And that mother's nature herself is she creates the illusions.
Yes.
She's a huge creator. Mm-hmm. It means everything in our world, in our natural world, but also our supernatural world, it's all under her domain. She made it. So for anybody to really understand, what is this life? Why am I really here?
Yeah.
Why was I born?
Yes.
What are the challenges of my life? How can I overcome things? What is the natural? What is the supernatural? What are the souls?
Mm-hmm.
Like this, to really understand these things, it is important to have a direct relationship with the Mother Divine.
Mm-hmm.
And Sri Kaleshwar has been giving that to his students over the last, oh gosh, I want to say since about 2000.
So in this lineage...
So 10 years now. He's been making an introduction between his students and the Mother in a very powerful and very beautiful way in order for them to start to understand how she is really, her greatness, her mischievous faces, her illusion nature, her touchiness, and how to start to play with her on a level that's, in effect, like creating with her something of great beauty and of great healing in this world.
Wow. I just went up to your center about, has it been a month? And was deeply touched by the depth of the teachings and the congruency between different masters and their similarities and the, well, for lack of a better word, learning what it is to create and destroy on a grand level. The destruction has to occur as well.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, the healing, the deep, deep healing and what that is. And it gave me a whole different understanding of the meaning of truth and healing. Do you want to share that a little bit?
Well, sure. I think when Swami Kaleshwar walks the world, he says the number one disease that he sees afflicting people is heartbreak. And that everything else, that everybody is suffering, regardless of their circumstances. Maybe they grew up in a war zone. Maybe they lost a parent. Maybe they were severely abused. Maybe they grew up in a perfect family, but there's still an underlying feeling of unease and discomfort in this
disconnect.
World.
Yeah.
Whatever it is, he classifies all of that as heartbreak, and heartbreak is the underlying condition that creates all the other problems in people's lives. And so his mission is to create healers who can address the heartbreak in the world, the suffering in the world, dissolve it, change it, turn it into something high positive. Which is a pretty big study, you know.
Yeah.
90% of the world is suffering under heartbreak, and I think he's being generous with that number. I'm sure it's more like 98%.
Yes.
But to create healers who can handle that, who can really not shy away from it, who have tools and techniques and power tools, you know, tools that come from the mother's blessing, really.
And are not misused.
Hmm?
And are not misused.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that part.
Oh, not misused.
No, and not
they're
at all
used
misused.
Truly
at all.
For
That's
healing
a really
in the
point.
Heart. It is.
No, but really to help, and only in the service of helping. In order to dissolve the heartbreak, and in order to get to the real nature of healing, which is, I think, my conclusion after all these years, is it's about the soul. It's not really about the surface. The body may show the physical manifestation of the disease. It may show through life challenges, maybe a betrayal in business, and then the death of a loved one, and then a car accident, and this and that. It may show a string of things that are reflections of the underlying heartbreak. It may be that, you know, we're suffering depression or anxiety or addiction.
Mm-hmm.
But what's underneath that, what's behind that, is, I think, the primordial heartbreak, and that mm-hmm. is the separation from God, the illusion mm-hmm. of the separation from God. And then every other heartbreak becomes a reopening of that,
that
original
yes.
kind of wounding that everybody is feeling, because mm-hmm. we're living in a world that, in effect, is not so real, and yet it seems remarkably real. And there's this kind of feeling of disconnect and uneasiness,
mm-hmm.
and maybe there's more to this world, but I don't even know where to start to look for that.
Yeah.
And so spirituality, I think, at its most dynamic is showing, hey, there's this doorway, and mm-hmm. many, many great souls have walked through the same doorway.
Right.
The doorway of meditation, the doorway of inner peace, the doorway of the heart really opening and then not staying closed again. You know,
yeah.
the way out of the heartbreak is reconnection with God. And so these channels are showing that, you know, and the teachings and the healings, whether they're addressing the physical body or they're addressing the emotions or whatever they're addressing, truthfully, they're affecting the soul.
Mm-hmm.
And they're creating peace and harmony in the soul so that somebody's own soul structure can actually heal their own system.
And what can you say about the soul? How would you describe our souls?
Yeah, I'm still researching on that. But, you know, traditionally they'll say it's a light. It's a flame.
Oh.
It's a small spark of the great light. And it has all mm. the attributes of the great light. Only, you know, mostly we've forgotten our own intrinsic connection with that essential part of ourselves. We feel it when we hear, for example, a beautiful piece of music and it opens the
mm-hmm.
heart. And then we have tears in our eyes.
Yeah.
Where are those tears coming from?
The soul.
Yeah, they're coming from, and it's very linked to the heart.
Mm-hmm,
you know,
it is.
The heart is kind of a doorway there to the soul's nature. So the soul also is coming into form and then leaving. It's what we call life and death. Then again, it's incarnating. Then again, it's living a life. And again, it's going
yeah.
out. It's learning certain things through each lifetime.
Yeah.
But the soul itself, it's not a temporary reality.
No.
It's an immortal
mm-hmm.
spark.
That is what is immortal within
mm-hmm.
us.
Mm-hmm.
And the beauty is that Sri Kaleshwar, Sai Baba, this lineage is giving us an opportunity to have a relationship with our souls.
Yeah.
Through these teachings, through mantras. Can you say a bit about your classes? I'm so new at this, I couldn't possibly give an adequate description of them.
So this path is about two main things, well, three main things. One is healing, and those of us who have done substantial spiritual energy development work are capable of transferring that energy in a specific way to someone else who has a healing need, whether it's physical, mental, emotional, spiritual, whatever it is. There are many, many different techniques and channels, as Alex was saying. Channels are an angle of energy, divine energy,
mm-hmm.
that's cultivated by the student through practice, through practicing certain ancient prayers, which are mantras,
mm-hmm.
which are vibratory formulas. And those formulas bring the divine energy in a very purposeful, specific way. And when you have tuned yourself sufficiently with that particular channel of divine energy, you can begin to use it. You can begin to pull it and use it to help another person.
Mm-hmm.
It actually happens rather quickly. The basic foundational class in Swami Kaleshwar's teaching is the five elements.
Mm-hmm.
The whole creation and all human beings are made of the five elements: the earth, the fire, the sky or ether, water, and air. Everything in the creation around us is composed of that. Now, each of those elements has a subtle energy quality as well. You could say a subtle energy signature. And those signatures are captured in certain ancient mantras, which were cognized by the ancient rishis. Rishis means seers,
mm-hmm.
divine saints, beautiful, evolved people and souls whose consciousness was so open to the divine reality that the blueprint of creation made itself available to their consciousness. They could see what is the vibratory inner nature of fire. And that is a certain mantra. Om Hrim Hefraim Hrim. Om Dim Dim Klim Klim Saum Saum Maha Agni Svarupanyena Namaha. And when that mantra is recited silently, mostly, by the student in a particular process while staring at a candle flame, and doing it for a period of time, in that case 41 days in succession, 108 repetitions per day, what happens is that our own inner fire element becomes aligned with the cosmic nature of the fire element through the vehicle of that mantra. And in the process of aligning with it, we are purifying our own inner fire element, which is responsible for our digestion, our creativity, aspects of our reproductive system, etc., etc. Fire is a key, you know, element in all human action. Another one is the earth. When you say the earth mantra, earth is characterized by magnetism. The magnetism of the earth, as expressed in gravity, if you drop something, the magnetism of the earth will pull it right down to the earth. So what happens is that the karmas and the results of our actions that we're doing, especially the bad ones, but the good ones as well, but the bad results of our actions stay in our system or come back to us and reside in the earth element in our system. And that's what eventually expresses itself as disease and depression, etc., etc. So going through the practice of doing the earth element mantra for 41 days is a purifying of all that's being held in our earth element structure, so that we become much lighter and less burdened over the period of time, and much more aligned with the positive cosmic nature of the earth element, which is also a huge healing element. So going through all the five elements in sequence, and this needs to be taken with a certified Kaleshwar teacher to get the understanding of how to do the process and the pronunciation of those mantras properly. But in a relatively short period of time, depending on how fast one wants to do it, you can go at your own pace. But in maybe 3 months' time, you can begin healing other people because you've already purified your elemental structure to such a degree that you can transfer some of that new enlivenment, that new cosmic energy that's in your system through having done the practices. You can transfer that to somebody else who is in need and help them relieve whatever the manifestations of their pain or suffering are. So it's a very spontaneous and kind of spiritual adventure type of process. It's very thrilling to go through it. You see it works very, very quickly, and it's delicious. You just love doing it because it's so uplifting and inspiring and energizing. So we teach the five elements here, of course, and people can take it either when there is a formal class being offered, which is from time to time. We also have one of our associates who lives here at the temple with us. Gautami is her name. And she teaches the five elements on a more private or small little informal class basis. And our phone number is 831-425-3234. 831-425-3234. And people can leave a message for us there, or go to www.karmatalk.com, which is our website, karmatalk.com, and see what's going on, all the activities. There are many, many, many activities up here that help students get the healing, whatever it is that they need, and then in the process of developing that, because it doesn't usually happen overnight. It happens quickly, but not usually in one session. It's an ongoing process to get rid of whatever the underlying causes are of the conditions that we have, whatever they are. So we teach, in addition to giving healings and healing energy ourselves, we also teach the students how to develop those same energy qualities and channels so that they can use them for their own healing and then shortly to heal other people as well.
Well said. And then on Thursday nights, you have kirtans and some teachings as well, and a meditation.
Yeah, every Thursday night we have a regular satsang, which is called Sai Shakti Satsang, and it starts at 7:30 p.m. People should carpool because our driveway is pretty small, and they can't park on Empire Grade Road. So just if anybody's listening, they need to know that. But the satsang every Thursday night includes some kirtan, some bhajans, sacred singing, a group healing meditation, and then a discussion on some of these beautiful teachings, you know, that we've all been absorbing here for the last 10, 11 years. But also we do a number of, you know, we are an active temple. We're actually a church in the eyes of the United States government and official organizations. And we're constantly having events. A couple of the other things that we do, every full moon and every new moon, we have fire homas. Jonathan was just talking about the power of the five elements. And the fire element is one of the most transformative, purificatory, astounding, powerful, high divine elements of all these elements in nature. The earth, the fire, the sky, the water, the air. And fire homas, or fire ceremonies, we do them on the full and new moons. One can do them any time, but to really capitalize and harness the extreme power that's flowing on those special days when the moon is full or when the moon is dark. And the next one actually will be next Wednesday, April 28th. People can see that on our website. And, you know, we're always teaching different knowledge systems and also doing full-on musical events as well. We do, part of this temple has a beautiful kirtan ensemble, which is sacred singing Sanskrit. It's kind of like a giant divine sing-along between the singers leading and the people. It's like call and response. So the people are responding to whatever the singers sing, so there's no pressure to have to know all these words or anything in advance. But anyway, the kirtan happens once a month, and it's an enormous healing. In fact, we call it music as medicine because it is medicinal and it is musical, and that's the nature of it. But Saturday also, this coming Saturday, at 7:30, we will be having the Mystic Jams. We'll be doing their monthly kirtan here at UCBK, which is exciting. That is an amazing experience.
And what time will that be?
It starts at 7:30 sharp, and again, it's a carpooling situation because of the limited parking here. We do have a carpooling coordinator. Her name is Carmen DeVita, and that information, again, can be found on our website at karmatalk.com. Under events, there's a link, and then a Santa Cruz events link. So people can email Carmen if they have space in a car that they want to help bring people, or if they need space in a car. And then finally, I want to mention, because we're talking on healing, that we are going to do an open healing day, which we're so excited about. We don't do them terribly often, so this is a really monumental, fun event going on here on Saturday, May 1st. And from 1 o'clock till about 7, we are open for giving Sai Shakti healing energy sessions. And people can experience it for themselves. They can make an appointment, again, going through our website at karmatalk.com or the phone number 425-3234. But we'll take appointments to like every 30 minutes, and there is a donation, a suggested donation of $30 per session. However, it's sliding scale, or, you know, if people are in extreme need, we never turn anybody away for a lack of funds. But rather than talking about the healing energy, people can come and experience it themselves. There are a variety of practitioners here. There's a variety of techniques that are involved, and it's really very, very specific to whoever it is and what their situation is. So it's not like a one-size-fits-all, you know, like one transmission of energy like Reiki, for example. It's someone comes in with a very specific issue, be it physical or emotional or spiritual in nature, And the practitioner knows from the basis of a conversation with that person what their symptoms are, what it is they're hoping to receive or experience, which techniques from an enormously wide variety, a tool set that's so enormous, mm-hmm. it took like an inch thick kind of telephone book format book to even put out in some kind of form about 108 of those techniques. I mean, it's
wow.
we have so many tools in this toolkit.
Yeah.
It's astounding. So
then
the healing session is sort of designed around the person specifically and what their needs are. And it's a beautiful way to experience what's going on here at UCBK and how it's been shining a light here in the Santa Cruz community for officially since 2007, but unofficially since 2005.
And not so quietly either.
Yeah, a little quiet.
Well, more and more people are hearing about you. Thank goodness. And what's so beautiful about the healings is that they go deep. They really do begin to touch the soul. And you may not realize that when you're having the healing, but I can say that you may get an inkling as to what you're doing here on the planet.
Yeah.
And that comes from the transmission, Sai Baba, Kaleshwar, the gurus. And it's from their ability to go inside of us so that we can connect within ourselves to that guru and then teach others. So it's about really transforming, alchemicalizing our world, our planet. It's time.
Yes, it's overdue, I think so.
I do too.
We've all been waiting a long time.
And there are so many lessons that we all have to learn, and it's why not start learning them and learn what karma is, what it isn't. You know, can you say a bit about the role of the guru?
Yes, and what I really want to encourage everybody who might be listening today is to go to kaleshwar.org. That's K as K A L E S H W A R, Kaleshwar. I'll say it again: K A L E S H W A R .org, and read the unbelievable amount of material that's on that website about the nature of healing, about the nature of spirituality, about some of the high processes that people are involved in. I believe there's even a link to an audio phone call that Swami had with his worldwide student community last October. So people can really get a very strong flavor of what he's doing in the world, what his mission really is. But I think I can just share one sentence about what I think the guru is, and then maybe Jonathan wants to finish on that too.
Oh, there's so much we can say.
Yes, well, it's an ocean, you know, that subject. But really, the guru's role is to bring the light into the darkness.
Yeah.
The literal roots of the words, the gu and ru sounds, they have to do with that. They have to do with the lightness and the darkness. And what it means to people practically is lifting our souls out of the illusion of the everyday world, which is predominantly a world of difficulty. This is a very challenging planet. I think anybody who looks around at a certain point gets a little baffled by how can there be a merciful, loving God, and yet so much pain and suffering in the world. It seems that there's a kind of logical disconnect there, or at least some sort of cognitive dissonance is present. And to make sense of that, really it takes stepping outside of that structure and seeing it from, let's say, a more divine place, or a place that's rooted in a reality that's lying behind this world, which is, as Shakespeare said, a stage, and each of us is a player on it. So the guru's role is he's standing, or she, is standing with one foot in the reality. Actually, maybe 2 feet, but are generous enough to stand also in this world and to ignite the inside guru in each of us, to wake up our own divine spark, like we were saying before, so that it knows itself to be immortal. That's not an easy thing. It's easy to say, okay, well, I know that I'm an immortal character. I know that my soul is immortal. I know that after I leave this lifetime, maybe I'm coming back again.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a different thing to experience that.
Yeah.
And the guru's job really is to give the direct experience of God to each character who's eligible to receive it,
mm-hmm.
so that they then will know directly themselves.
Well said. I've always wondered how that, what the role was, and how the energies awakened the knowledge within, the wisdom, the truth, and to explore that.
Mm-hmm. So the mantras that the guru gives.
Oh, the Sanskrit, yes.
Those vibratory formulas pull huge cosmic energy when we recite them silently, internally.
Mm-hmm.
And that brings the guru's energy, the guru's love, the guru's grace, the guru's attention inside us, where it starts to operate. And what it does is purify our system on every level, vibrationally, physically, emotionally. It begins to elevate the level at which our whole system is functioning. So we become more open to the cosmic energy, more clear, more receptive to it, more able to hold it, more able to listen to its guidance, so that our real soul purpose, our soul dharma in the world, is easier to understand and then to implement. So all this the guru is doing. The guru is a bridge. The guru is here as an advocate for us. If we open our heart to him, he becomes our advocate, our champion in the divine court. He tries to help us get there, get to where we really are. So he's working simultaneously inside us and outside us. He manifests circumstances in our lives that bring front and center to our attention the main challenges, the main issues that we need to look at and to learn from. He manifests that in our circumstances. People coming to us, making comments, challenging situations coming, helpful situations coming. That's all part of what the guru's grace is.
And
it provides a like a stage script, a screenplay, in which we go through our role and learn what we're supposed to learn, either quickly or slowly, depending on how stuck we are, how open we are, how willing we are, how surrendered we are, how egotistical we are.
Mm-hmm.
All of those qualities, both our good qualities and our bad ones, our blocks. And the guru works with that in an infinitely patient, but also very prodding way.
Mm-hmm. Can't be fierce.
They're not there to waste time, but they're not there to be impatient and judgmental either. They act as kind of a mirror to us, but in a very positively angled way.
Mm-hmm.
They will point out to us just in the circumstances that manifest around us. They'll point out to us where we're making mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
If we can get it and absorb it, and then with our free will take a step in a more positive direction, then we go very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
If we resist it and fight against it and deny it and hide from it, then the next round becomes more intense.
Mm-hmm.
And the challenge gets a little more focused. And then we see how we do in the next round. So, I mean, it's an absolutely divine
Leela.
Leela means play.
It is.
Divine play, and it's really the only show in town. Once you develop a taste for it, there's nothing else like it.
And you know, the gurus, the masters, the teachers, the medicine people exist in most traditions, and just about all traditions, and they just have different names. They're individuals like us who know what they're doing. They know, they've mapped it out. It's been mapped for them, and they've done the work. And they're gifting us by giving us that opportunity to start doing the work as well. And as you say, it can become, I could say, it's a dance. You referred to it, the play. Leela?
Yes.
Yes. Wow, we have shared a lot. You've shared a lot. I've learned a tremendous amount this hour, and I cannot thank you enough. I'm truly honored that you, came on my little tickling.
And we want to invite all your beautiful listeners.
Yes.
And you, of course.
Uh-huh.
You're already, you know, coming regularly.
Yes.
We want to invite everyone to look on our website at karmatalk.com Swami Kaleshwar's website at kaleshwar.org, mm-hmm. and to come up and visit us on a new moon fire homa. The schedule is all there on our website, or the full moon, which is coming up next Wednesday, or our bhajan concert this Saturday evening, 7:30, or our satsang even tonight. Mm-hmm. But please, we have to remind everybody, you must carpool.
Yeah.
We do not have the space to accommodate people coming individually in cars. So if you go on the website, there is a link to our carpool coordinator. And actually, Carmen. Alex is looking for it right now. No, it's where is it on the website? Under the different events, how to carpool. And there are many people coming from Santa Cruz and coming from over the hill and coming from Scotts Valley and the mountain area. So it's not so difficult to put in with somebody and come as a carpool. And it's no question, it's a huge, beautiful, universal divine energy which is flowing here.
It truly is, and it's in the midst of beauty.
Blessing. Our job is to share that as widely as possible.
It is
and
your job.
As helpfully as possible. So whatever problems people are dealing with, we're here to try to help to the best of our ability to give solutions energetically through the healings, also to enable people to heal themselves and to understand how to use the spiritual tools to improve the quality of their lives and also ultimately to help as many others as they can. That's what we're really here to do, is help each other. That's the message of the Universal Church of Baba's Kitchen.
Yeah. And to pierce through those illusions before you're creating more.
Creating more truth and less illusions.
Yes. I said before creating more illusions. It's a spiral.
But as we become more aware of how the game is unfolding, I think we more and more are able to see through the illusion and create what Swami Kaleshwar calls resistance power.
Yeah.
So that we can operate in the field of illusion, in the ordinary world, but our soul has the resistance power to not get overshadowed by it and to stay on its true purpose, which is where the real happiness lies, not in the transitory ups and downs of the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to, as Shakespeare said. We really have to get off of that hamster wheel level of existence in order to really enjoy ourselves in a profound,
profound way.
Lasting way.
Yeah. Well spoken. You two are extremely articulate and were able to describe what I have been sensing. And we're extremely fortunate to have you in Santa Cruz. Just outside of town.
Yeah, we're so happy to be here, and really, you know, it's God's grace that we can say anything about anything.
And I love hearing your stories about India and your experiences at the temple and Laytonville. Well, we're going to have to end it. My next guest is here now. We're going to be learning again about the Mexican history of Santa Cruz. And again, I cannot thank you enough. And I'm truly honored to know you.
Well, thank you, Cindy. We'll see you soon.
You certainly will.
Okay. God bless.
All right. God bless you, too. Bye-bye. Wow. That was Jonathan Rosen and Alex Utterman of UCBK. And I really want to invite any of you to go up there, read their website, and with an open mind, you will be extremely surprised. And it is in the midst of beauty. It's like being up in the Himalayas. And with me now is Julia Langerhan. Hi, Julia. She's back. She's written another volume. This time it is about Carmel and Monterey. And we're going to go more deeply into the Spanish royalty from southern Spain. But before we begin, I'm just going to play a little bit of music here. Let's see. Let's listen to Warriors on the Way.
lay out, lum 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 lady lay, he hum lum lay out, lum lady lay out, liddy 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 liddy, hey a hoka hey, liddy 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 liddy. I see a white horse, an angel standing, goddess standing in the lotus sky, red as a dragon's eye, but light like a feather. And way across the horizon, deep in the hills, thunder is coming, echoing valley. An elven king, gentle, his master moves in robes of wind. And the poet on your breath, sweeter than peaches, bitter as grandfather time, may slip past you in a rhythm and shadow, but is received between the lines. Liddy, 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 liddy. Hey, ahoka, hey. Liddy, 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 liddy. Ring them bells, child. Ring them bells, child. Ooh. Ring them bells, child. Ring them bells, child. Because there's no place like home. No place like home. No place like home. Ring them bells for life. There's no place.
That's true. There's no place like home. And home right now is Free Radio Santa Cruz. And that's 101.1 FM, what you're listening to. And online, it's freakradio.org. And we are always looking for donations, and you can mail those to FRSC P.O. Box 7811, 7811, Santa Cruz 95061. And my next guest, Julia Lengerhan, has brought a rose, a beautiful orange-smelling rose, into the studio. So I'm looking at that right now, and I'm smelling it. And I know that spring is here and the meaning of rose, although we won't get into that right now. But Julia has been on before, and she's actually back by popular demand. And she is the author of The Haunting of Mission Santa Cruz, Mexico, from 1708 to 1876, Volume 1. She's just completed Volume 2, and she goes into more detail about the Mexican history of Santa Cruz. And this book is more specifically about the Mission Carmela, when it was Mexico, governed by the Anzarin. How do you pronounce that?
Yeah, it comes from the word azulín, which means
blue,
so it's
people.
Anzarin.
Of the Southern Spanish royalists, including the famous Mexican Spanish governor, Joe Castro, and his heirs. But let's get started here. She told me a bit about Wells Fargo and its roots
in
this
in
area.
Santa Cruz.
Yeah, do you want to go into that a bit?
Sure, let's start with Great Aunt Mary Agnes.
Sure.
So one very famous person to the Santa Cruz area was Klaus Spreckels. He was the sugar baron, actually.
Spreckels?
Spreckels sugar. Spreckels.
Yes. Yeah.
He came to possess a part of a very important Spanish land grant called the San Andres land grant that was given by the Southern Spanish royal family to the Castro Moragas. The Castro Moraga come from the root word Charlemagne, and these are very old families that had peace treaties in southern Spain with northern Spanish before the Castilian princes came to power, which is where the Castellanos in the northern
Spanish. That goes way back.
It doesn't go that far in reality if you realize that the last Muslim city of southern Spain to be overthrown was Granada in 1492.
Oh,
So when they overthrew the Muslim city of Granada, we had the flight of most of the southern Spanish monarchs into Mexico, which they already had territorial possessions as Spanish land grants. Mm-hmm. So there was no such thing as Spain, per se, but this was Vispania. It was a favorite wife of a Roman emperor who became famous in southern Spanish port of Cadiz, which is a city of Al-Andalusia, which means Al, where, Andalus, where there is light. And the last city to be sacked and thrown, these people, these monarchs, were deported to Mexico. These people had a lot of wealth in their Spanish land grant. So what
they were royalists.
They were royal family, and they set about to reinforce their territorial possessions in Mexico after they lost their control of the port of Gibraltar. Mm-hmm. So this is a very important port at one time. It was controlled, and it's named after a Moor named Jabal Tariq. And this Moor had peace treaties with Theodore the Goth at the same time as the great Martin Luther. These reforms were taking place. He had peace treaties with the family, a royal family of Royal Rodriguez. And these families actually had Spanish land grants here in Santa Cruz. Mm-hmm. Now, what I'm trying to set up is that there was an enormous amount of wealth and exchange because there was always tributary being sent back to the main caliphate. So southern Spain had their caliphates in the capital, Córdoba.
Or caliphates.
Caliphate, this is where we actually get the word California. It comes from the word califato, which means a union of enlightened spiritual authorities. And the Umayyads were the first caliphates. They produced 12 caliphs. These are great enlightened thinkers in the line of the Prophet Muhammad. Now, this is 1260 to around 1320. The last southern Spanish city to be sacked in the mid-1300s was Sevilla.
Sevilla, yeah.
Now, these famous Spanish families that actually helped the northern Spanish come to power fought under Zayd Rodriguez Diaz, the famous Zid, the champion in battle, who fought with Don Quixote. You know, everybody knows the story, but we don't know it very well.
No, we don't.
What's Don Quixote and El Cid? You know, Cid?
Mm-hmm.
It comes from the word Zayd. And his name was Zayd al-Campitur, which means the champion in battle.
I was going to say conqueror.
Yeah, the conqueror. He actually helped the northern Spanish come to power, and the Castellanos. And this is also where the King Sancho and King Sancha. So in Mexican Spanish, everybody still knows how we use the word Sancho and Sancha. It's still with
us.
Well, it's how we say when we're like cheating on our spouse. We say we have one of those. But these are the treaties. So there was these alignments of marriage, intermarriages between the Rodriguez family, which were the guardians of Guadalajara. You see, this means guardian of God's flask. Guarda, guard. Allah, God's name.
Allah.
Jara. Jara is
the Moorish.
Yeah, it's a flask. It holds something. So jara in Spanish means, I don't know, pan, or it's hard for me to translate. Just a water container, a container, a flask. So the Rodriguez Real family were actually ruling in Guadalajara, Mexico. And these are southern Spanish royalists. And they had already signed peace treaties with Charlemagne, which is where we get the name Carlos Moraga.
Ah.
And the Moraga family had the Spanish land grant to Santa Cruz. And that's the famous Joaquin Castro Moraga.
So these were land grants.
The only village,
per se, you had told me, was Villa Branciforte.
So Villa de Branciforte
surrounded
was
by
the city.
The land grants, the rancheros.
And so the mayor, so actually today's the anniversary, and it's very nice to be honoring the anniversary of the lynchings today. So the book is basically about the land grabs, which are not... The forgery is that there's a huge gold rush where everybody came to make their profit in gold in California. What really happened is a well-premeditated and well-planned rape of the land, the properties, the women. So Reverend Sassuolo, who traces his roots all the way back to King Richard of Sewell, this is the origin of the word Wells. Okay, I'm going to try to explain the origin of Wells Fargo here, which were...
I knew we'd get to it.
A conglomerate of families that actually were children of Heinz, which is the ketchup heir who stole the tomatoes, you see. Heinz comes from the German word Hern, and his name was Hern Sassuolo. which mm-hmm. became Shewell or Sewell. And he's buried in the Harvey West as a Sewell. And his daughter, Ada Bell, came as Wells. And that's the forgery on the Loudon Nelson Center here, the school, that it was a black man. It is a black man, but they were black Moors, and they were Basque, living in Monterey.
Basque.
This is where the family Vasquez comes from, you see? And the Basque are very unique in Spain themselves, speaking something that's different itself from Spanish.
And they're somewhat oppressed as well.
And they're somewhat oppressed, and their roots go back. I hear they're kind of Celtic roots. So the Basque are in themselves.
You whisper that. Yeah. Why?
I don't know fully yet, but I'm coming to discover these families. The Vasquez were the heirs of Monterey, and where the corn grinder is in Monterey, that is an adobe. One of the oldest adobes is Rose Castro. Rosemary Castro, we talked about her before.
Yes.
She was the last wife of Joaquin Moraga. And she went missing in 1838, but she turns up in the convent in Mission Carmel. And this is why Book 2 had to come out, to tie up the loose endings from Volume 1. So in Volume 1, we find Rosemary and her son George's tombstone in Mission Dolores in San Francisco. And it actually marks the location of the Empress of Mexico's bones. Unfortunately, she died in 1832, and Alviso, or San Jose, was the capital of North Mexico. And there was a coup so the Empress went into hiding.
What is Alviso today?
So Alviso is a drowning city north of San Jose that used to be a major port of entry and was the capital of Mexico until 1833. The capital of North Mexico was up here because it had water access. Mm-hmm. There's lumber, timber.
So there's wealth.
Yeah,
that's
there's the
why
wealth.
This
there's
land was
trees,
so desperately
the fruit.
Valued.
The leather, the tanneries, the the fields.
Yeah.
So
bountiful.
Basically, the book is about the reality behind the land grab of the San Andres Spanish land grant 30 years after the Mexican-American War's over. So we're not talking about Mexico losing a war and giving up their land and going home, which you will find on the forgery in San Juan Bautista, specifically talking about Rosemary Castro. She said, oh, well, she finds herself now a Mexican girl in America. What does she decide to learn English or go back to Mexico? You see, this is a forgery because this is Mexico and the land and language are protected.
Go home? This is home.
You can read that. Actually, it's on what they publish as official history in San Juan Bautista, where you will actually find... what's unfortunate about this space is that there's a cemetery of unmarked graves. And that doesn't have to be. We had the sophistication to put the grave name on who is under there. But what they did is it held so much information. And it was the Breens from the Donner Party that helped participate and move that cemetery. So they took all the stones.
Well, they saw their end.
Oh, yeah, so it is basically these Bengal boys. We have the root of Wells Fargo. So what we want to talk about is it's very complicated. It's a very complicated history. But Mary Agnes was the wife of Klaus Spreckels. She was a Heinz daughter. Heinz had children with four different very important women.
And he was one of the Bengal boys that murdered many of the
Mexican heirs.
Leaders, Mexican heir
so
leaders.
On this day in 1876...
The Bengal boys came from the East Coast.
Yeah, they came from Maryland, from Tennessee, from Alabama,
Massachusetts.
The forgery of the Heinz family is that they're the descendants of Mary Scarborough of Maryland with the daughter of the famous colonizer John Sloan. You see, John Sloan is everywhere here, but pay attention. Joan Sloan. Joan's son. You see, it's a Johnson. He broke down these kind of names, and then he inverted them.
You're amazing the way that you are able to break down the names, and you have a background.
In linguistics. Yeah, so
you really do know how
about
to...
About the transition of language and phonemes over
and
time.
And turn things backwards.
And we come from a non... we're not actually a linguistic-based culture. The reservation I lived on in New Mexico, they still largely dance their philosophy. And what I was actually came to the university to study was embodied culture, where people are still dancing, where we're not dependent always on the written culture.
Yeah.
So the written culture is what we have today that we put a lot of faith in. And there was this gentleman back in 1876 that had a lot of power to introduce the forgeries that we reference as official Santa Cruz history. And his name is Alfred Frederick Joseph Hearn Sullivan, you see, Sassuolo. This is where we get the word she-well, which has become the word wells.
Wow.
So the forgery on the Loudon Nelson is that a black woman named Ada Bell Wells and her black family, and that she struggled for black suffrage, and she did. But you know what? She wasn't that black woman they have pictured there. Mm. Ada Bell Wells, which her name should be She-Well, because her father was the Reverend Sassuolo She-Well.
They had no qualms with changing names.
No, they did a lot of changing names. These inversions, they helped kind of disconnect heirs to a lot of money that was stolen. And one of the main persons involved in these robberies and actually introducing forgeries, quote-unquote Civil War forgeries, was the Huggins family, you see. And that was Mary Agnes Huggins. Mm-hmm. And she was the wife of Klaus Spreckels. And she actually came to possess the Bayview Hotel, which is in Aptos, the apple orchards,
yes.
the Mangles Mansion that's in Aptos used to belong to a Castro. And it was her older brother. She was only 13 when the Bangle Boys lynched the governor and the mayor here.
Oh.
And there were 10 of them. And you can find them in this book written by Reverend Saxon Stanford or Safford. It's dated 1892. It's one of the oldest books in the UCSC library.
Now, what was it about this area? We've talked about it, but we can just, if you mm-hmm. could talk about that with our listeners. Why did they want Santa Cruz so badly?
What was interesting about the Jones, and you can find their information in the Mormon Battalion files, they were colonizers, okay? So they had this great idea that they were going to come and colonize Mexico, but they kind of leave out of the Mormon Battalion file that Mexico was San Francisco and Santa Cruz. So William Henry Burt Jones.
Rich.
Yeah, he was the Grand Master of a Ku Klux Klan, but now we have the Texas Lodge Order of the Masons in San Juan Bautista. And if you go there, right across from the mission.
No names.
Yeah, it says Texas Lodge. And what do you mean, Texas Lodge? We're in California. Well, he had a son that was named John Burt Jones. And John Burt Jones married Leona Jones, and Leona Jones is my grandmother.
Oh, boy.
So great Agnes, Mary Agnes.
What's cursing through your blood?
Yeah, these things have to work out, you know. The former speakers, you know, gave a very nice talk on how to kind of confront so we could move through these things. And the more that we would push against and avoid them, the harder it's going to be for the next lifetime to work through, right? They said something like that in their guru speak.
Well, you're healing the generations, I suspect.
Well, there was this family here, the Heath family, but it comes from their Hines, actually, the Hines family. But Hines, not a real name, you see. He was an expert in hiding and putting his name on everything. So Hines just means Mr., but his real last name was She-Well. And he had 8 children. And the Heath are also 8 children now. But they have very many different names, you see. Mary Agnes, who was the wife of Klaus Spreckels, she actually has a name on a forgery, which is the Huggins forgery, which is how the actual Porter family got the land and the Wells Fargo came about. Mary Agnes was the first school teacher to mission Santa Cruz, and she was only 13 years old when her older brothers, the Williamsons, which mm-hmm. were, they overlap in with the Heath family. These Williamsons participated in the lynching of the governor and the lynching of the mayor. So the governor was named Joe Castro, and his real name was Juan Jose Chacon Rodriguez. Mm-hmm. Now, Chacon, his father was a famous man from the 1760s, and his name was also Juan Jose Chacon, and it comes from the word Al Charcon. It means the pooling of water. You see, there's very many water rivers that pool together here. Mm-hmm. And he was
and
the real founder.
And that's why it's so powerful here.
In Santa Cruz, the forgery of the Chacon name mm-hmm. has been forged over to say Lawson. Lawson. And this is also where we have the forgery of Loudon Nielsen, Cornelius's son. Hans Cornelius's son. And so we have Hansen becoming
Nelson.
We have Hansen and Lausen overtaking Chacon. And it's a very easy forgery. It has to be similar enough to forge. And his birth certificate, he was born in 1817 in San Juan Bautista. His parents were founders, Franciscan founders. His mother was a Rodriguez of the family Rodriguez Real, and his father was a Chacon Medina Salazar de la Villa Señora. These are long
beautiful
names to say that they're from the mountains of the Holy Mother. You know, and they're talking about mountains in Al-Andalusia, where there is light. The Red City, where there is light. So it's beautiful. It's southern Spain, but see, it's all Spanish Arabic, and it's all over where we reside.
So there's the Moorish influence. Yeah, it is. Right here in Santa Cruz,
that's
if you can
right
read between the lines.
You
have your
to read between the lines.
Background. You know that just instinctively.
It's become part of my training. I wrote dictionaries, which means I'm very good with graphs and family trees. And we used to build databases that could search for different spellings of the same word. So this is kind of, I think, helped me and see, because how I found out the forgery was actually given to me in an antique store by somebody who owned the box of the Wells Fargo. And he pulled out pictures I have of Mary Agnes and her husband, Klaus Spreckels. And this Mary Agnes was actually not only the first school teacher to Santa Cruz, but she got the main piece of the Magnolia Rose, which is a piece of a dismembered mansion that's now moved from Capitola to Santa Cruz, which is the main theme of my book.
Yeah, is that where Castro lived?
The Castros built these mansions. Okay. These mansions were stolen from them. And on this date, April 22nd, 1876, Book 2 documents the murder of 14 Castros and immediate heirs to these beautiful mansions. Now, what happened is that they were dismembered and moved around. And the moving, and then there was a fire staged in 1907. There was this great earthquake in 1907 in San Francisco that went down in history of San Francisco burning down.
Gave them their excuse.
It gave them their excuse. And so when the lynchings took place, some of these gentlemen, they were all Heath's children, Hines' children, Huggins' children.
That's why there were so many. They learned how to be murderers.
Yeah, and they followed Papa, and they were loyal. And actually, so Ernest Amesti's real name was Loyal Heath, and his actual name was
Loyal Heath.
Yeah, so there's an overlap.
They make a joke out of it. It's almost a mockery.
Well, and he's Ernest Amesti. That's the real Ernest Amesti. He's one of Williamson's, and he was John Peyton Williamson. And this is the son he had with Matilda Hearn. And Matilda's mother is Rosemary Castro, and Rose Castro went missing in Mission Carmel in 1838. Matilda is born in 1841. Now I'm going to tell you the Hines line. Matilda first is born in 1841. Then his daughter is born from Rose again, and her name is Alice. And she's on the Huggins family tree. Her name is Alicia, but she was Alicia Sullivan. Yeah, you know, pay very close attention to this, is that the first woman he raped was Carmen Pacheco, and her father was a Portuguese man. So a lot of the beauty that came out later in some of the Williamsons was not German or Scandinavian. It was Portuguese. His second victim was Rose Castro, who went missing into the Mission Carmel because of a pregnancy, out of wedlock pregnancy in 1838. And then he started raping her. And she's the mother of the Williamsons. And these are John Peyton Williamsons of Lafayette. Two of them were Ku Klux Klan that lynched the governor. Now, Matilda had also this son named Carlos, John Carlos, and his name, John Carlos Lenahan, is on the highest point of Holy City, and his name is on the plaque inside the Santa Cruz High School, and that's Ernest Amesti. He helped put all the San Andres land grant into the hands of his father through an open auction that was held. And he, for $2,000, he took the San Andres land grant of 10,000 acres and put it into the hands of his father, which was Joseph
and his
Hines.
Descendants are doing that today with many of us, as people are facing foreclosure and their homes are in auction. It's going back to the banks.
And so the bank is actually where these families. So what happened is that Mary Agnes, or Mary Mangles, that's where we get the name Mangles Mansion, which is on the Klaus Mangles Mansion in Aptos. That was Rafaela Castro's mansion. She was killed on this date, too.
And where is that mansion?
It's in Aptos Village. If you just go all the way up the mansion, it'll say Mangle's house. And it's in private hands to this day. It's a 7-bedroom mansion. Used to belong to Rafaela Castro, who was the heir of the Castro Moragas in 1838 when her father, Joaquin, died. And her mother was the hiding empress of Mexico.
Oh, my God!
And they hid her in an orphanage until she was 8 years old. And then she came down the Alviso Slough before Alviso started to sink as the northernmost city in the San Francisco tributary. They brought her to an orphanage called the Mud Flats Refuge. Mm-hmm. And it's still standing to this day. I've been there. And
where is that?
It's in the north of San Jose in the city called Alviso that's about to go underwater. Well, see, what happened is that there were sloughs that brought boats in, steamboats and large boats, but then the culture of lines and straightness, they straightened out all the tributaries, so the city of Alviso went underwater and no longer do boats enter the port of San Jose like in the past.
Oh.
San Jose was a port city, and I have to tell you that water went all the way into these great mansions, even including the Winchester Mansion, which Mary Mangles came also to possess. Through her older brothers, which were the Williamsons that did the lynching,
mm-hmm.
her husband, Klaus Breckels, who participated in the lynching and came to control the Castro land grant to the Hawaiian Islands, which was where the sugar cane came from.
Spreckels.
And she was the school teacher inside what they call the Winchester Mansion. So there's another forgery right there saying that nobody, you know, that she had no friends, that she was the last heir, that she left no children. Well, actually, Mary Mangles was the school teacher of...
She had many children.
The Bechtel children. And this is the origin of Bechtel. It's an 18...
Bechtel, the mercenaries, the large corporation in San Francisco.
B-E-C-K-E-T-E-L, Bechtel.
And Wells Fargo is also in San Francisco.
So Mary's family line is the Wells, which comes from Shewell. And Mary, as a school teacher in Santa Cruz and also at the Winchester Mansion, which I possess in my their personal property of my own, which Mary Mangles with 38 of her children standing in front of the water tower on the Winchester Mansion.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
and everything there
of
is
these children,
but it's
three
stores.
Of them, which are her children, and they're also pictured on the main piece of the Magnolia Rose here in Santa Cruz. Those are Willie Bechtel, Jenny Bechtel, and Lulu, which comes from Olita or Lolita Bechtel, which is the famous Lulu Carpenters,
which was at that time. It's now a cafe.
And it was in the past a hall of records that stood in Branson 40, and it was inverted a complete 180 degree the other way. They did this, you see. After the murders, they moved the buildings to create a forgery of a city. So they created the city of Santa Cruz in 1877. There was no city there before.
It was all land owned by
the governor's family, and there was a university there. So the University of California, Santa Cruz, it did not start in the 1960s. It started in even before the 1860s, 100 years before they even say. And the evidence of that, if anybody wants to see, is go look at the old Santa Cruz High School that's to the left of the church up there. The bell mm-hmm. tower stood there, and it wasn't a bell tower for a church. It was a class. It announced class times for students attending school.
So this whole area was for advanced learning, and who knows what kind of advanced learning, too. You can only imagine.
And it's closed down now, right? It's very hard to access that building.
Yes, it is.
It's the main, and you know, the train track, they blew a hole in the mountain under that holy mountain. So you see, Santa Cruz...
They just desecrated the whole culture.
They desecrated the whole culture.
As if it was never, it ceased to exist.
Well, I wanted to say that the Rodriguez Neri adobe that's up on Mission Hill in Santa Cruz, that's the recycled bricks inverted 180 degrees around. Also, I'll turn it, I think I'm a little loud.
There.
See if that's better. Yeah. Anyways, a little off track, but let me just tell you about Mary Agnes. Is that her children were her students as well, and her children bear the name Bechtel, and this is an $18 billion company in San Francisco. And Mary, as she was the school teacher, which is written on the back of this card that
you know
I own
about Bechtel.
Yeah, we know about Bechtel. All the no-bid contracts in
Iraq and much more.
Trying to privatize the water in Bolivia.
The energy, the oil industry there.
So
with their hands and everything.
Her children were, I'm reading from the back of her own handwriting, Jenny Bechtel, Willie Bechtel, and Lulu Bechtel. And her, she signed herself as Miss Bray Fogel. Her father was a Wells or a she Wells, and she's a Bray Fogel. And this is where we get the word Wells Fogel or Wells Fargo. In 1907, they staged the fire of the Great Magnolia Rose, which was this hotel on the Capitola Esplanade. Grandpa Sullivan, you see, he also had another identity as John Thomas Sullivan, and this is Alfred Hines. Hines' children, it's the same man. He created a Bango Boys unit of 10, and the majority of these 10 are his own children. So Ernest Amesti was one of the Hines' children with Matilda. You see?
So you weren't kidding when you said he created a family.
He created a family.
Thieves and murderers.
And then what they called themselves were like breakaway Freemasons. But the more I think about this, is this may not be representative of the... Well, I'm not sure how much he really represents what was going on in the Freemasonry, because he himself was a breakaway minister, quite in control, and in control of his own family, which did these murders, and then were in place to smear the people afterwards. So the Jones smeared them in the newspapers. The Jones were already working with him, and this is where the black man, Loudon Nelson, comes in. William Henry Burt Jones was a black man. And see, they're not black per se. They're black because of his rape of the Moorish line of the Vasquez from Monterey.
Yes.
And he himself, when he wrote his family tree, because he was raping his own family, you see, he had Alice from his own daughter, and he raped his granddaughters, probably every family line all the way down. So Amos Williamson, he called a Huggins. And Huggins, if you spell it backwards, I hate to say this, but it spells nigga.
Oh.
And he called his own family line with the Moors a Huggins.
Disgusting. Oh, my God.
And it's a
God.
Forgery. It's a straight forgery, because his name was John Williams. And what he does is he breaks it down and he puts his own self.
It's simple to just turn the word backwards.
So instead of John Payton, which was his real name, he became the Petty Johns and supposedly married the daughter of John Sloan.
They just had fun writing out
well,
this
the person that
tree.
Left this forgery, I have to say, was Mary Agnes. She worked for her father. She was very loyal to her father. She introduced these as Civil War forgeries left in place by the Wells Fargo family to be found to this day.
Were these, you said that the Carpenter Building, which is now Lulu Carpenter's, was a
hall of records in Branca 40.
Were these birth records, birth and death records?
These were after.
What kind of records?
This was a forgery deliberately left by Mary Agnes through a male identity. She assumed, I'm quite sure this man didn't exist.
She assumed a male identity.
She did the same. They had multiple identities, and her male identity was Eli London Huggins.
Huggins again.
And this is where the Porter family comes in. So they created a forgery.
I guess they had to do this because they were small in number.
Well, they wanted everything. So one way that they took this, the Ernesto Amesti took that big piece of Coralitos. Well, there was a forgery on George Castro's death. So we talked about George on the last show.
Mm-hmm.
George was Rosemary's last son, born to her when she was still married to a Castro Moraga, living at the Castro Adobe, which overlooks Watsonville. It's one of the oldest adobes still here for us today. It was in private hands, donated back to the state, thank God, but they wanted it to fall into the earth. Because if they have to put the history back on that adobe, they have to tell the story of the Castros, and you don't hear very clearly that story here.
Mm-hmm.
So Rose Castro was 22 when she had little George, but their deaths were staged, you see. Rose went into a convent and George went into an orphanage. George was tortured and murdered by Alfred Hines. We talked about him
mm-hmm.
last time.
We did.
He was my grandma, Alicia, who's another Huggins' boyfriend. Thank God, you see, we got some sperm in there, because Hines was raping Alice since she was 10 years old. And Alice... grandfather is Tiburcio Vasquez, and he was a very dark Mexican Moor, and this is where mm-hmm. the black comes.
Uh-huh.
So the Jones, it's
Mexican,
kind of,
more
yeah.
From southern Spain.
From southern Spain and North Africa, which was the famous, I can't remember, but it's Joseph. His name was Joseph that came in, and he was a ruler, Alfonso, 1292. Let's see if I can remember what he did in 1292. I'll have to remember later,
sure.
But we link him up all the way back in the book in Volume 2 with the peace treaties he was also signing with Theodore the Goth and the great Martin Luther that was pushing the Lutheran reforms that mm-hmm. the Heinz family went completely against, you see. They were Puritans. The idea of enlightenment is that you can't change with times.
The Heinz were Puritans.
Yeah, they call themselves breakaway Puritans from the Massachusetts Bay, tracing themselves
yes.
all the way back to Mary of Scarborough, it's very hard with forgeries because you don't know, there could be information, there is information, but at the same time, you can't trust the information.
Some of it is true.
Some of it could be true, and I'm not sure.
Yeah.
So this thing of Mary Scarborough of Maryland, I'm not sure. But mm-hmm. also John Sloan, I know that's a forgery, and it comes
to
from
the pieces together here.
Johan's son, and they were Scandinavians, and they actually are colonizers in Piedmont to this day. See, they wanted to build colonies, and what they did with Santa Cruz is they made it very inaccessible. So they blew up the train that went under Lexington
and
Dam.
And it was not. It was easily accessible
it was,
prior
and
to
yes,
that.
Yes, everybody was here. The Russians, the Vikings, the Spanish, the Northern Spanish. Une pero será.
And it is strange. You would now have to go over Highway 17 even now. And then
it's so hard to get anywhere from
down.
Santa Cruz.
I know, on the coast. So they blew up the trains, did you say?
There was a railway under Lexington Reservoir. There was a city there that's underwater. And so Alviso's underwater, Lexington's underwater. The Rodriguez Neri's, the old recycled bricks of the original mission church, inverted 180 degrees. And underneath that building, just like the mission in San Juan Bautista, there are tunnels that lead to other locations. So,
oh, my.
This is how they disappeared children, you see. So I'm trying to tell you is that George Castro's death was used by Heinz to make himself related to the Castros and take that land. So what he did is that there was this last pregnancy on the Rancho San Andres when the Castros were still in possession, and this was to Rosemary Castro. But the person who lived there, Rafaela Castro, was the wife of the governor, and she hid during the census under the name Maria Rita Pinto. Rita Pinto, that's Pinto Lake in Watsonville. It's named after
it
her.
Is.
So what happened is that last baby was named Rudolfo, but they didn't know whose baby it was, so they made a mistake calling him Rufo Pinto. And his gravestone is in the cemetery in Monterey, the Catholic cemetery in Monterey, and so is Heinz, and so is Elizabeth Heinz. And Mary Agnes is a sister of Elizabeth Heinz, but Elizabeth's father was Coleman Watson, which father was George Castro because he got some sperm in. But Mary Agnes is where we get the name Mary Mangles, and her name is still on that mansion in Aptos Village.
You better not tell us where it is, because I can imagine there'll be a little pilgrimage to wherever.
Everybody can make a great pilgrimage to the Bayview. The people there are lovely.
Poor present owners, I'm sure.
And it was, the Bayview Hotel in Aptos Village. It's a 14-bedroom mansion built by the same family, the Castro Moragas, was heir to Rafaela Castro, who was killed by the Bango Boys in her own house up in Aptos Village, which Mary Agnes came to possess and who's hanging in the dining room. She was a redhead. Just a very strange one, a dark with red. I'm not sure about this, but that's where I think the Celt and the Basque seed came out.
And now how are you leading to explore that?
Well, we have gained entrance to the majority of the mansions. We do work with the people that have worked there the longest, which are usually the caretakers, the maids, the people
yes.
cleaning and caring for the garden that have been there years and years. But the people have been lovely. The people have received me very well. What's interesting about the main piece of the Magnolia Rose and its dismembering and moving is that they brought all of what was in Capitola, which was maybe 100 bedrooms.
Wow.
They moved 14 bedrooms to Aptos Village. That's the Bayview. They moved it twice so that the forgery comes with the last move. They'll never tell you that it was in Capitola. And all the pictures that exist have been photoshopped by Thomas Sullivan himself. That's Grandpa Heinz.
Photoshopped.
And, yeah, photoshopped. Well, he's sophisticated. If you look at, there's a picture of them hanging at the Winchester Mansion, all 10 killers plus Mary. Mary's there. But if you look carefully, there's not 10, you see. There's an overlap in two of the Williamsons with two of the missing Heath. The Heath's mausoleum is in the Harvey West. If you go look, their plaques inside the mountain, there's some missing. The three missing, they overlap with the two Williamsons and Mary.
Oh.
You see, Mary Huggins, Mary Spreckles' wife, was also a Heath, and she was also one of Hines' daughters. But her mother was Alice Sullivan. And Alice Sullivan's grandfather was Tiburcio Vasquez, and he was the mayor that was lynched on this date in 1876.
By the Bengal Boys.
You
don't know specifically which ones are...
Yes, there were seven. And so the first one is John Peyton Williamson Sr. That's Hines himself. His two sons, Amos Williamson, which him and his brother, Charles Loyal Williamson, their names are dedicated on that main 1928 monument in downtown Santa Cruz at the head of Front Street. Go see their names. They're there. If you go inside the Harvey West Cemetery, John Williamson's, there's a great cemetery plot dedicated to them as colonizers on what parties they came. They're there. Mary's there too, but Mary's really there. Mary has two plaques on her grave, and it says Mary Armory Case. And they made a joke of her all the way to her death because, you see, you know how they like to call her Mary Winchester because she did gun running and all this? Well, in her death, they called her a case of armor. Mary Armor Case. But see, it was because the Williamsons were Ambrose, and so they tried to change like an Ambrose to an armory. And if you look at the plaque on downtown Santa Cruz,
they
changed it to Amos. They were gun runners. But it's because they weren't having a civil war up here. You see, the civil war was fought in the South and the North. But it wasn't fought in California. California had 30 more years of Castro running the government. And these infiltrators got started between 1863 by 1876. The governor was lynched. Governor
so
Joe Castro.
It was after the Civil War, the Mexican-American War, and then they came up here and started to take over the land.
And he actually operated in the church. So he was
the Congregational Church.
He was the first Congregational minister to Santa Cruz in 1873. He was the superintendent of Catholic schools to Mission Carmel in 1863. He already had access to start his rapes by 1837 of Carmen Pacheco. And this is where this forgery I have in my hand starts. And I have the eight children. Rufus Amesti Huggins. We have to say that's very sad to say what they're doing to the family name. But his death is recorded December 16th, 1862. And that is George Castro. And Grandpa Hines used the death of George Castro to link himself to Rafaela Castro through this last birth, not knowing really who the mother was, whether it was Rose or Fala. That's her nickname. And I found that tombstone in Monterey, and it says Rufo Pinto. So he's number six on the Hines line. And then we have Mary, which is Mary Agnes of our talk today, the heir of the Magnolia Rose. She came to own the Winchester. She came to be the first school teacher to the Rodriguez Neri Adobe. She's the mother of the Bechtels.
She did have children.
Yes. And she's the mother of Ada Bell Wells, which is the forgery on the Loudon Nelson that says Ada Bell was a black woman. I own the pictures
dark
of Ada Bell.
Moorish
she
woman.
Was dark, but she wasn't black. And Ada Bell, she was actually my Grandpa Lonergan's mother. So Ada Bell and her husband, Ernest Lenihan or Ladigan, or however they tried to say my name, I have to this day, Lonergan, which is not Irish, and they lied. They're buried in the Harvey West as Shewells. And Ada, Grandma Ada, is referenced in the Loudon Nelson Center as Ada Bell Wells, a black woman. You see, they got part of it right, but they got a lot of it wrong.
Yeah. And purposely.
Purposefully. So it's very interesting. The last son, which is through the Amesti, Charles Loyal, which would have been Williamson Peyton, had Elizabeth Ray, which was baby. On my family tree, we call him Baby Roy. And it sounds like a boy, but it's a girl. And then Auntie Helen, who I met, and she married one of the Williamsons after their assassination. His name was... Again, Kurt Nielsen, like the Louden Nielsen, Curtis Cornelius' son.
Yeah.
And
creative.
She was a Wells, and then their third daughter was named Bernice Huggins, and she married a porter. This is how it goes.
On and on.
On and on.
And there's more and more of this.
And there's so much more.
And I'm curious, what can you say about Junipero Serra?
Yeah. So we have to pay very careful attention to the politics in what was Spain, North and South Spain again. Mm-hmm. In the North, we have the Holy Roman Empire, you see, and these are Catholics. In the South, we have the Holy Muslim Caliphates of the Emirs of America and Califatos of California. And they were fighting to keep these treaties from exploiting complete Mexico. So the Northern Catholics were looking for peace treaties with the Southern Mexicans, you see. We're Northern Mexicans up here in the North. So Mexico's huge. If you think about the Camino Real extending all the way into the Yucatan Peninsula and coming all the way up through New Mexico.
Always the North and South divide.
Another North
Almost
and South divide.
The globe.
Yeah, so the North are Catholics, and Junipero said I was a spy. And he actually helps plant those forgeries that Monterrey was...
A spy for Northern Spain.
For the Austro-Hungarian, the Holy Roman Empire, which also... Yeah. They have a lot of bad politics, huh?
They've
had a lot of bad politics.
All the way.
Yeah. Wow.
But you're digging in and exposing it beautifully.
Well,
he came over here as an observer then.
He came as an observer and a spy, and he actually had dinner at the Castro's, at the Castro Adobe. I don't remember where I found that, but I found it. I found it in some document somewhere.
You know, you know so much of what really went on here. And you said that you may be having some lectures or classes on this history at the Bayview. Have you pursued that anymore?
You know what? We're going to get started. If anybody's interested, they can send me an email. And I posted on Santa Cruz Indie Media pictures of the mansion and like an announcement of the classes. So we're going to start a lecture series.
You'll have a
series.
Ball doing it because you know this so well.
Oh, we're going to have a blast. Mansion tours. We're going to have high tea at the mansion. So, and we'll start with the class of at least 15 so that I can walk you around the mansion. It's a 14-bedroom that was connected by a staircase of seashells down the Capitola Esplanade into a piece that's now the Red Room, which is a lounge and bar in Santa Cruz. That was a piece of the Magnolia Rose. Then you walk through that into the main dining halls, which have become Heinz Victorian Mansion, which is on Chestnut in downtown Santa Cruz.
Yeah.
That's an 11-bedroom, and they got just the main dining halls and piano bars. But the main piece is called the McLaughlin Mansion, and that's also came into Mary.
Westcliff.
That's on Westcliff, and Mary Agnes came into possession of that, and her children are hanging on what would have been the fourth floor. Because now you see the bottom floor is missing.
So you would feel the haunting.
So what's up with the haunting?
The spirits. Every place you mention is known to...
carry something.
Yes.
And it's famous. Something. I knew before. People told me when I came to Santa Cruz. They said, have you seen that? That mansion on the hill with the suicide door, which is this upside down cross that you can almost... if you walked out, you would surely die.
Yeah.
Well, my son's little girlfriend introduced me to that mansion as we were working, and surely it's a piece of the Magnolia Rose. The piece that they use as a carport has two bedrooms on top, and then the main mansion has nine bedrooms, and that's where the main dining rooms are, the main salas, the main ballrooms, the main silver room. It's the most beautiful mansion I've ever been in.
It must be. And yet, energetically...
it's hurting. It's hurting. So the bottom floor is the laundry room there, and it's just full of junk and laundry. But it used to be the lobby of the Magnolia Rose when it stood in Capitola. And see, there was this little elevator that you could take a train.
What a desecration.
Well, because in Capitola, what did the Swansons put in its place was bathrooms, right? If you go to Capitola, you know where the bathrooms are?
The bathrooms at the beach.
At the beach?
Yes.
That's where the Magnolia Rose stood.
Oh, no.
Every single place, they moved the entrance to the exit, So at the Rodriguez Neri, it's inverted. The Heinz Victorian is dismembered and inverted. The Magnolia Rose is inverted. And then they were placed in the city of Santa Cruz. So this is my thesis, and this is the main theme of the book, which makes it kind of hold together is that the murders took place in the Magnolia Rose, April 22nd, 1876. Mm-hmm. The lynching of the governor, they took him from the Rispin Mansion. That used to be the White House here. They held him. There's underground tunnels. People know about this. I wasn't the one that figured it out. People told
me. It's new to me, though. And
well, there's two tunnels underneath the Rispin Mansion where they tortured him. And they used those during Prohibition for bootlegging. But there's two more tunnels that they haven't found yet. And I know that. Okay.
And you know where they are?
No, but someday we will.
I want to be there when you discover them.
It's going to be fun. But actually, Alexandra Pacheco Castro, who we talked about before as the woman who infiltrated the Freemasons as a man, she fled for her life from Kraus Spreckels, and she hid money in that mansion as she fled for her life.
Oh, we have to go there.
She fled to a place down on the Rio Grande, which became the new north of Mexico, and the Burt Jones went after her. You see, he had the task of, you know, the bad Mexican, capturing the Joaquin Murrieta's. You see, this is where we get
the
legend.
The
If you translate Joaquin Murrieta, and of course Joaquin was the name of the owner of 10,000 acres here. Murir is the word to die. Murrieta, you can say Joaquin Murrieta, he should die. And Arano, yeah, they took the name Moraga, which comes from Charlemagne, which was the guardian of God's flask, Guadalajara. They were very important monarch, children of monarchs that received these Spanish land grants. Moraga has become Arano. So at the Bayview, the builder is Joseph Arano. Now, this is also a curse, because if you put the M back on to Arano, it becomes Marano, and that means pig.
Oh.
And you see in the Moorish culture, that's a curse to the Muslims. They did. You see, Heinz, he was a member of the Freemasons. He knew old rituals. I'm not exactly, I don't know these things myself, these rituals. I don't know where they're documented, but each of the mansions and the murders were used to create a negative energy in Santa Cruz that's playing itself out, I think, in our children, in our youth, and what we have with the mental illness, lots of bipolar, lots of suicide, lots
of
drug
abuse,
lots of death. Santa Cruz, didn't we just have another drive-by shooting a week ago of a youth?
I wasn't
youth
here, but you're
on the west side.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, so Santa Cruz has a history of being a beautiful facade, but underneath there's something not right. It's the whole inversion
and
of...
And I think people sense it, too. I don't know if they do. I can only speak for myself, but sometimes I sense something's a bit off and...
I lived on the mountain. I lived on the Santa Cruz mountain while I was working on my PhD for 4 years, and people kept saying, you know, it's paradise. And
I kept hearing too.
I couldn't understand what was the matter with that mountain, and there's a curse on that mountain because it is actually the ascension of the Holy Cross. It is the big, beautiful. We could be on Mount Zion for all we know.
I know.
And we have to get ready to understand how to respect the land we're on.
And I'm curious about that institution of higher learning.
Yeah, where the bell tower
here,
stood.
Why we never knew about it. And why were the buildings purposely inverted and then dismembered along with the residents inside of them and then their pieces spread? Ugh.
So what happens is that what I'm coming to understand is that even the dead need their possessions. Like the Egyptians would bury their dead with their possessions, and they'd say they needed them in the afterlife. And for our culture, we don't understand that. But
this culture doesn't
understand it very easily.
Anglo-Saxon.
But, you know, they need their stuff to be in how it was. So what happens is that they wander through doors that have been moved and opened and disconnected. And to find the door that went there is causing them dilemma. Yeah. And each of these pieces have been strategically placed around downtown Santa Cruz in a perpendicular fashion. We should not be going perpendicular to the ocean. Most cities that are beachside go parallel to the beach, not perpendicular. So we have a perpendicular front street, and between the Mission and the McLaughlin Mansion, which was Mary's husband Samuel Prescott Bush's mansion, there's a little overlap between Kraus Spreckels and the Bush family here.
Do you want to say a little bit more about that?
Well, I'm still something I'm working on, and I'm looking for some evidence.
Next time you come on.
But I have two pictures of them.
I want to start with that.
Samuel Prescott Bush, I have a picture of him as Mary's husband. So we'll do that. We'll look into that next time. But basically, the dead are wandering their dismembered mansions, and they're very upset about it. That's the theme of the book.
And if they have nowhere to go.
And you know, it's the recurring nightmares.
If you die in shock like that, where does the soul go? There's
the lynchings. Yeah. They were all strangled. Cookie Castro, Rafaela, Juan Jose,
mayor. When you come back, I want to start with Spreckles and Bush.
Yeah, let's do it.
Get to the root of this.
Let's do it.
And much more. But it's 5:05. We're going to start Palestinian news. And
okay, cool.
Stick around here.
Thank you.
All right, that was Julia.
Lonergan.
Sorry about that mispronunciation.
No, it is
really
all mispronounced. It has 4 or 5 spellings.
I believe
you probably have the right pronunciation.
Whoops. Let's see. Here we go. Thank you for listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM. And this was Tickling the Belly of the Beast from the heartland of Santa Cruz. We do accept donations. FRSC, P.O. Box 7811, Santa Cruz 95061. Please send
them in. www.imemc.org for Wednesday, April 21st, 2010.